You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, U.S. and North Korean relations, we are joined by Jonathan Granoff, who is president of the Global Security Institute. Granoff is an international lawyer and former professor of international law and serves as a senior advisor and special representative to the United Nations for the Permanent Secretariat of the World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates. He is the chair of the Task Force on Nuclear Nonproliferation of the International Law Section of the American Bar Association and ambassador for peace and security of the Parliament of the World's Religions. He serves on numerous advisory and governing boards such as the NGO Committee on Disarmament, Peace, and Security at the UN Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, Middle Powers Initiative, Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament, and the Jane Goodall Institute. He is a fellow in the World Academy of Arts and Sciences and recipient of numerous awards. Jonathan Granoff, I could keep going with your biography. Welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I think it's great what you do. Most of the media sort of dumbed down complex issues where you actually seem to unpack them. And this is really important.
Well, we will try. And there's hardly an issue that has been more dumbed down than U.S.-North Korean relations. It seems that especially in U.S. media, you just get the perspective of the U.S. government, whereas if something's going to be negotiated, it requires that each side try to see the other side's perspective. What do you think the current crisis looks like from the North Korean government?
They're completely terrified. We recently sent some strategic bombers very close to their borders. B-1B bombers can carry nuclear weapons. We continue to have military exercises with tens of thousands of troops on their border. Our president has insulted their president, calling him Rocket Man, which, if you know anything about Asian culture, it's very, very disgraceful to disgrace others publicly in that manner. They have reciprocated knowingly. They have reciprocated by insulting our head of state. The level of rhetoric has descended to despicable trash talk, like basketball players. Maybe it's because the only person who seems to be friendly with heads of state of both countries is Dennis Rodman. So they're very afraid. The Korean War has not ended. We're in an armistice, so the war has not ended. They've been asking for an end of that war. Their memory of the Korean War is still very alive there. You have to realize that about 20% of the country was killed. All of its major cities were leveled, and so they have a victim's mentality. They've been isolated from the international community. So they feel very threatened, and they feel threatened reasonably. There's reason for them to feel threatened. They are run by a small cadre of the Kim family that is tyrannical and brutal. They have had food shortages, so their domestic stability is uncertain, and they have no real allies. Their economy is weak, and we have a president and a secretary of state who are speaking inconsistently, which leads them to be even more afraid. So that's what I think it looks like from their perspective.
And what does that mean that they want? They want the threats to stop and the name-calling to stop and everything will be okay?
Well, it's not just name-calling. I mean, They want some form of non-aggression treaty, something that clarifies that we will not invade them, which they would reciprocate. They want a normalized relation.
Can we clarify for those of us who think of ourselves as humanity rather than as the U.S. military, that what you mean is that the U.S. military not invade them?
Oh, right.
When you use the first person, you're not speaking for one of your wonderful organizations. You're speaking for the Pentagon, right?
No, I was speaking as an American.
Right.
When I said we, the North Koreans are informed by the consequence. The way they look at it is that Muammar Gaddafi, another tyrannical dictator in Libya, gave up his weapons of mass destruction program, which he had as a deterrent, and ended up being assassinated. Saddam Hussein, it turned out, had also given up his weapons of mass destruction program, and he was assassinated. So they're very afraid that if they give up their weapons of mass destruction program, they too could be assassinated. So they want some form of formal agreement that they will not be assassinated. The United States military will not do essentially subject them to what happened in Libya or Iraq. They want respect. So they want some form of normalization of relations with the international community. They want to have us stop hindering their economic development, resume oil shipments there, increase food aid, and give them some degree of respect. That's what they want. And they have stated consistently that they'd be willing to give up their missile development program and probably cap the nuclear program. I don't think in the short term there's any possibility that they would give up an existential deterrent of a handful of nuclear weapons, because they're reasonably afraid.
It seems like back in the 90s they made an agreement with the United States that both sides more or less kept until the United States decided they were in an axis of evil and were the enemy, and there was no need to abide by agreements with them. And it seems like the United States has recently made an agreement with Iran that was essentially, we won't attack you if you do these things with your nuclear energy program. And now the United States president is saying, I don't care about abiding by that. How could we be sure that an agreement between the U.S. government and the North Korean government, even if one were to be made, that the North Korean government would believe it?
Well, first, the arrangement with Iran was not an arrangement between the United States and Iran. It is actually a Security Council resolution. So the president of the United States saying he's going to renegotiate, that's very problematic as an American, because it derides the United Nations Charter, which gives the Security Council authority to make resolutions that are binding on everyone in the world. So when the United States says we're going to renegotiate, it's in a sense saying we're not going to honor a Security Council resolution. And that to me is a huge problem. It's a constitutional problem, because our Constitution brilliantly states that treaties are the supreme law of the land. That's in Article 6, Clause 2. So when our president derides the treaty, like the United Nations Charter, it not only puts the rest of the world in a position of great fear, it should put any serious American citizen in a position of profound concern, that our own Constitution is being derided. I think we have a trust deficit. I think in order to give North Korea confidence that we would live up to agreements, it will take time. There's no quick solution. And similarly, by the way, they're completely untrustworthy. They have lied. They have cheated. They have probably engaged in building a nuclear facility in Syria that the Israelis bombed. They've shared missile technology with Pakistan. So they're completely untrustworthy as well. So building trust between nations is not easy, but the alternative of trash talk leading to actually trashing millions of people's lives is not a wise course.
I could not agree more. We're speaking with Jonathan Granoff, who is president of the Global Security Institute, among other things. And just to be clear, the U.S. has a half dozen wars going now in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria, and they're all in violation of the U.N. Charter as well as the Kellogg-Briand Pact as far as treaties that are the supreme law of the land in the United States, are they not?
That's an interesting question, whether our counterterrorism wars are illegal under U.S. law. I don't want to go into that in depth because all of these wars, some are not really wars, some are military incursions. They may be acts of war, but they haven't evolved into full out wars. Wars take place between nations. These are military actions against sub-state actors. So it's a technical matter. They're not really wars. But what I am concerned about, if you want to get into that, is the president of the United States threatened to annihilate the people of North Korea. That's a reasonable interpretation of his fire fury language. And that's a threat of genocide. That's clearly illegal and out of bounds. There's a doctrine of international humanitarian law, which is the law of war. It's sort of the lowest boundary of human activity is war, and this is the boundary of even that activity. And the United States military takes it seriously. If you read the manuals of our militaries, it is our policy to abide by those rules, which prohibit attacking civilians, which prohibit excessive force beyond a specific military objective. And annihilating a country is completely outside of the boundary of the rules of war. And I'm sure that some of our military legal experts were shocked when he said that. I was shocked when he said that. It's completely un-American. I don't know whether he meant what he said. I don't know whether he understood what he said. I don't know if it was, like just basketball trash talk.
Well, on other occasions, he's used phrases like totally destroy.
Yes.
Senator McCain's phrase is exterminate. I could give you, dozens of more. There was a question last year in a Republican presidential primary debate. Would you, as president of the United States, be willing to fulfill your basic duties and kill hundreds and thousands of innocent children? I would argue there's nothing more American and hasn't been since the founding of this country through genocide. It may be taken very seriously in writings by the U.S. military, but I would challenge you to find a war or a non-war war action of the past decades or centuries that has acted as if it took those concerns seriously.
One of the reasons why we prevailed in the Cold War is that we took the moral high ground as much as any state in the modern era can.
Really?
And, we never had gulags like Stalin. We never had extermination camps like Hitler. And it's never been a state policy to engage in genocide as other empires have done. You could argue that you could take the perspective of Native Americans that the entire American venture of the United States is based on the genocide of the indigenous peoples. That wouldn't be a far-fetched perspective. But on the other hand, we are the country that has propounded the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We are the country that's founded on the magnetic compass point that all people are created equal. The United States is like anything in the world. It has its good and bad side. I want to be a patriot and argue for the good side and push in the good direction, call us to our higher ideals. the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt inspired the world around that led to the creation of the United Nations system. These are the ideals that we still hold dear. And I think there's enough Americans who, certainly the American people, believe that any military engagement that we ever engage in is for the highest, most altruistic purposes.
And they do.
They do. And, you know, and that's just not real politics. But, you know, I don't want to argue whether whether our country is better than any other country. The fact is there are universal principles that allow us to live in a relatively civilized era. You and I can talk openly right now. There are many countries you cannot do that. But let's talk about what the actual law says. The actual law of our country is that treaties are the supreme law of the land.
Indeed.
And just because we violated them, you know, we shouldn't throw it out. It's like just because people commit murder, you don't throw out murder statute. I think we need to hold our political leaders accountable, severely, more accountable than anybody else when they cross the line.
Do you think that 6 million dead in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia was part of the moral high ground, or was it some comments that were said about them not caring as much about dying being Asians that was, I mean, where I'm looking for the moral high ground through the Cold War, because this is a new one for me.
The Cold War was really, to some extent, a result of the overreaching of Stalin, that Joseph Stalin did have gulags, that Joseph Stalin did engage in mass killings and deportations and horrible things, and America, instead of being brave and free, responded with great fear and trepidation, not understanding that the Soviet Empire was a very weak empire, and that as soon as Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev started talking to each other like human beings, and realized that the Soviets were not demons, and they realized that we really didn't want to invade and destroy them, the Cold War ended. It was basically when we started acting like human beings, we arrived at human solutions.
And this is
the Vietnam War was we kind of backed into it. It was a colonialist war. I mean, Ho Chi Minh's inauguration speech was founded, if anybody, you know, goes and hears it, it's amazing. It's founded on our Declaration of Independence. He wanted to model Vietnam on our constitutional democracy, and our response to him was bombing. It was a terrible, terrible thing that we did.
Yeah, I didn't do it. Mikhail Gorbachev has suggested. No, I'm not with you in the our country thing. I'm not
identifying with
a country here. I'm identifying with humanity. So the first person is your first person, not mine. But Mikhail Gorbachev has suggested that as he successfully talked with Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin ought to try talking. And Jimmy Carter has suggested that as he successfully negotiated with North Korea, the U.S. government ought to. And he, by the way, has made friends with Donald Trump to some extent. Why can't Trump send him to talk with Kim Jong-un? Why can't talking be tried with North Korea now?
Well, I hope it is. The curtain hasn't closed, and let's hope that there are talks going on at a lower level than what the press reports. And I think that, you know, sending President Carter over there, that would be a brilliant thing to do. He's a brilliant man. He still has energy. He has wisdom. William Perry did a great job when he was Secretary of Defense. He could have resolved it. But Rumsfeld and Cheney convinced President Bush to scuttle the progress that was being made. So, no, I couldn't agree more that direct talks are exactly what's needed now not tomorrow, but today. And the fact that our Secretary of State has said that he wants to pursue diplomacy, but then at the same time he says that he's going to negotiate, but that the precondition is the concession of the other side to what you're demanding without giving them anything. That's not negotiation. That's not good faith negotiation. So it's incoherent. It's very difficult for the rest of the world to understand what America actually wants to achieve right now. This is true almost everywhere. I mean, look at our policy toward our allies in Europe. Stephen Bannon has made it clear that he wants to destroy the European Union. The president refused to explicitly affirm Article 5 of NATO, which is our military unity. And at the same time, our Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State extol the virtues of the European Union and the strength of NATO. So our own allies are sitting there scratching their heads and saying, exactly what is the policy of the United States? This incoherence is very dangerous and very destabilizing, especially when the United States makes a big deal about North Korea's testing nuclear weapons. Now, and I think it is a big deal, I have to say. It's a terrible thing that they're doing. They're a dangerous country. But they've only tested 6 times. We've tested over 1,000 times. We have thousands of nuclear weapons at the ready, remaining on launch on warning. These thousands of weapons are subject to computer error, human error, and each day we live on the precipice of nuclear annihilation. The existential threat between the United States and Russia of our launch on warning hair trigger alert system remains, as it did at the height of the Cold War. There have been numerous computer errors that have created the appearance of launches on one side and the other, and there's inadequate time to reflect. I mean, I just think if there was a weather satellite launched off the coast of Norway in 1995, and Boris Yeltsin had less than 8 minutes to decide whether that was the first volley of a nuclear exchange, which would have been a high-altitude hydronuclear bomb exploding and creating an electromagnetic pulse that would have fried their communication systems in Moscow and the rest of the country. And he's had a few minutes to decide. Imagine Donald Trump having a few minutes to decide whether a computer error that registers a Russian launch is real or not. And these things have happened. There was one where we put a computer chip that hadn't been programmed to distinguish between its first sunrise perception and a nuclear attack, and it looked like we were under attack. There's another instance in which people put a training tape in, and Brzezinski was informed that we were under attack from the Soviet Union. It was simple human error. So we sit here on the precipice of nuclear annihilation, and the American people are focused on North Korea, but the real threat that we face are the thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at us right now from Russia. So talking, absolutely, they should get down to the process of fulfilling the duty under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty to negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons universally. That is a duty that it remains outstanding. It's a legal duty, and we ignore it at our collective peril.
Indeed. And last year, North Korea was the only nuclear nation in favor of creating a new treaty that has now been created and is in the process of being ratified around the world. I agree with everything you've said about, North Korea, nuclear weapons being a horrible thing, but putting it in terms of context, what exactly do you think is the threat from North Korea? Because I get emails every day saying, if you don't stop opposing wars, you better learn to speak North Korean, whatever that might be. Are you concerned that the North Koreans are going to invade and occupy a nation 10 times its size? Or what is the danger?
the danger is that if we precipitate aggression with North Korea, that they will attack South Korea. And, you know, in the area of Seoul, there's, you know, in the suburbs and the city, there's probably about 20 million people whose lives are at risk.
Yeah.
It's likely that they're on the verge of, or they have crossed the barrier of being able to deliver a nuclear bomb upon Tokyo. Then there's the danger of the state of North Korea collapsing, and we don't really know exactly how many nuclear bombs they have. It's, you know, experts speculate between a dozen and 60. But we do know that if you had a failed state, that it would be very difficult to track what would happen to them, and that would be the great danger of a sub-state actor getting them. There's an ongoing danger that they need cash and they might sell them to somebody. So if you have a loose nuke or loose nukes out in the world that sub-state actors have, we call them terrorists, that any city anywhere could blow up, and that could take down the whole stability of the international order. I mean, just imagine if a sub-state actor got a hold of one of these and blew up any city, and then said, "We have one in a warehouse somewhere in Washington or New York, and these are our demands." The stock market would close. The stock market would cause a economic collapse of the international order, and people would suffer enormously. And if they actually blew one up, the trauma, I mean, we could forget the Fourth Amendment. We could forget all of our civil liberties in the United States. So there's very, very real dangers of the instability that we're living with right now. And I think it is imperative that the President of the United States designate somebody with a cooler tongue to negotiate both with North Korea and immediately begin a joint enterprise with Russia on how to assure each other that we don't need nuclear weapons to maintain our security. I mean, does anybody really want to, like, nobody I know in America wants to invade Russia and take them over? And I've been over there and spoken with many people. They don't have any desire to take us over. So why are we pointing these nuclear weapons at each other and putting the whole world at risk? To quote Robert McNamara, who gained his sanity in his latter years, it's insane, and it's immoral, and it's illegal. And we have to change.
On those points, I agree entirely. Jonathan Granoff, I wish we could go on. We're running out of time.
Could I just end with something that I think is very pertinent? Ronald Reagan was absolutely correct when he said a nuclear war can never be won and therefore must never be fought. 120 nations in the United Nations this year have voted in support of a treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons. The International Court of Justice has unanimously ruled that there is a legal duty to negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons. There is a legal duty under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty for the nuclear weapon states to negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Donald Trump has called the opioid crisis a public health emergency, which sounds like a welcome change from when, for example, crack cocaine was called a reason to put its users in prison, and maybe their children too, for good measure. But at the same time, Trump's call for a war on opioid use and a just say no style media campaign sound like very old and very discredited ideas indeed. What's going on, and what would be a better way forward? We'll talk with Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno, Executive Director of Drug Policy Alliance. Also on the show, the New York Times columnist Brett Stevens says combating rape on college campuses is a laudable goal. Quote, even if evidence of its epidemic proportions is sketchy and good numbers are all but impossible to come by, close quote. A statement he immediately followed with what he presumably believes to be that rare good number. Quote, in 2015, 89% of colleges and universities reported zero incidents of rape, close quote. Well, that's the paper of records columnist's basis for describing Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's change in official guidance on campus sexual assault as the end to a campus witch hunt. So, while some media are imagining that the Harvey Weinstein scandal represents a serious rethink about rape culture, others are saying there's really nothing to see here. Alyssa Peterson is state organizer with the group Know Your Nine, that's Title IX. We'll talk with her about Betsy DeVos's approach to campus sexual assault. That's coming right up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Donald Trump called on the Department of Health and Human Services to declare a public health emergency, stating in what the New York Times called an elaborate and emotional ceremony that opioids represent, quote, the worst drug crisis in American history, and even, if you really think about it, world history, close quote. As is often the case, it wasn't exactly clear what he was talking about, but media aren't always much clearer. Is the crisis overdose deaths, opiates themselves, their overprescription, their use, addiction, the issues that lead to addiction? You don't need to be in denial about a problem to recognize that the definition of the problem will affect the response. And when it comes to the war on drugs in this country, it's not as though there is no record to check. So what does Trump's recent declaration mean, and what possible responses to problems associated with opioids are existing but maybe not mentioned? We're joined now by Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno, Executive Director of Drug Policy Alliance. Welcome to Counterspin, Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I've heard Trump's declaration of a public health emergency around opioids described as good but not enough. Good, but it needs money attached. We can be grateful for official attention, which we know is meaningful, but if a policy is wrongheaded or misdirected, it's hard to wish that it had more fuel behind it. I wonder if you can just walk us through some of the things that you found problematic or that concerned you about Trump's declaration.
Yeah, so I wouldn't call his declaration good. I would say that there were a couple of good proposals buried in there that might mitigate some of the harm of the overdose crisis. But overwhelmingly, his speech just betrayed ignorance and perhaps deliberate indifference to the realities underlying drugs and drug use in the United States. And if the U.S. really pursues the path that he has charted in his rhetoric, it's a recipe for more overdose deaths, continued harsh war on drugs, and no real meaningful progress.
Well, you have said that the war on drugs is a factor in the overdose crisis. What do you mean by that?
A big part of the problem here is the war on drugs itself. The fact that for over 50 years, the U.S. has been focusing on strictly prohibiting access to certain types of drugs and using criminal justice responses to deal with them. As a result, people who use drugs are often doing so underground in ways that make it much more likely that they will overdose, much more likely that they will encounter substances that have been adulterated, for example, with fentanyl, and have no way to check them, much more likely that they will not have basic information about how to mitigate risk. For example, a huge number of the overdoses that we're seeing right now have to do with mixing substances, with mixing opioids and alcohol, or mixing opioids and benzodiazepine. Those deaths perhaps could be prevented if people knew that mixing was a major factor in overdose. But right now, public education around drugs doesn't really get into those issues. And what Trump was proposing in his speech was a return to just say no style ad campaigns and education campaigns from the 1980s, which, you know, are what the Reagans pushed and were proven to be utterly ineffective because young people tend to dismiss them as patronizing and not based on reality.
Yeah, I mean, just say no. I think many people thought that that was kind of a punchline at this point, you know, but now it's being reintroduced as actual policy. And Donald Trump has said of opioids and of drugs in general, it's really, really easy not to take them. And it seems sort of emblematic of a bifurcation, of a difference, you know, where some people think if you talk about drugs, it's the same as sex. You know, if you talk about it, that's going to make people do it. And so what we really need to say is, no, that's not acceptable. You won't do that. That's not going to happen. And then you don't get any clarity about what happens if it happens.
Yeah, I think we need to talk about a fundamental shift in the way we frame drug issues. I think we need to, as a society, and certainly the government, needs to recognize that drug use is a fact, that there are always going to be some people in society who use drugs, whether they're legal or not. Then you have to look at, okay, some people are going to use drugs, some people will misuse drugs. How can you reduce the likelihood that people will misuse drugs and that they will have the whole host of problems that are associated with misuse? And how can you mitigate the risks that the worst things will happen, like overdose? If you approach it from that perspective, then you're talking about, for example, supervised consumption sites, which San Francisco is now considering and Seattle is considering, which would allow people to inject drugs under the supervision of trained professionals who can make sure that they don't overdose, make sure that they're using clean needles, which reduce the likelihood of infection, and refer them to treatment or other services as needed to help them if they want help. But instead, you have this just harsh black and white, just say no mentality that is still reflected in the criminal justice system, where if you use drugs, the sole response is punishment. And that hasn't worked. The U.S. has done that for 50 years, and it's landed us here. It's time to think about new, more compassionate, and frankly, more evidence-based scientific approaches.
Well, I wrote in Real Time about corporate media's near gleeful promotion of the idea of crack babies, children whose mothers used crack while pregnant, as a race of subhuman drones, a bio-underclass, a group of people whose inferiority was stamped at birth. It was vile and racist and wrong and had an impact, you know. And I just wonder, is it possible to go forward without reckoning with that? Lots of folks have talked about, you know, the difference, the sort of more public health-based and compassion-based approach to opioid addiction, which is affecting primarily white people, and comparing it with crack. But it's not, though, that race is somehow absent in this current conversation, though, is it?
Well, I think that people who are being impacted by the opioid overdose crisis, they're people of all backgrounds and colors, but the focus has been on the impact on white people, and that's because the highest increases in overdose rates have been seen among white middle-aged men. And so there's this perception that the overdose crisis is about white people, when in fact, many people of color are also affected. I think what we need to consider is, one, that yes, society as a whole is treating this crisis differently from past crises, but it's also not talking about all of the horrible ways in which the criminalization approach has impacted people of color by incarcerating and arresting enormous numbers of black and brown people in grossly disproportionate manners. A black person in Manhattan is 11 times more likely than a white person to be arrested for simple drug use, even though they use drugs at the same rates. And that tells you something about how the war on drugs has been waged. There are generations worth of harm there that have been done that need to be accounted for, that aren't just going to be wiped away because states might start looking at opioids. And I think we also need to watch out for responses that may look more compassionately at people who use drugs or may offer, you know, more treatment or more access to naloxone, which is the overdose reversal medication, for people who use drugs, but still come down harshly on people who are perceived as supplying or distributing those drugs. And that was in Trump's speech. Trump spoke about immigrants who are supposedly bringing all these drugs across the border and how we need to solve the problem by building a border wall, which, again, is an old, old solution. The U.S. has poured billions of dollars into trying to stop drugs from coming into the United States, and it has completely failed, not for lack of trying, but simply because when you talk about an illicit market of this size, the amount of money that organized crime can get through it is so huge that they can always find new ways around the barriers that the U.S. puts up. And every time the U.S. or Mexico or another country arrests a senior leader of one of these groups, somebody else comes in and fills their shoes, because it's that profitable. So again, this is a never-ending war. It will not stop, because the more money the U.S. puts into it, the more profitable it becomes. And it's just this vicious cycle. We need to find other ways to deal with these problems that aren't just criminalize, demonize certain communities. And, you know, the other piece of it is, of course, he's focusing on immigrants, or as in the past and to this day, demonizing certain communities as being responsible for drug problems, when in fact that's a gross exaggeration. It involves stigmatizing people, and it's going to do terrible harm.
Well, let me just ask you finally, sometimes I think in part because of media, it becomes difficult to see other ways out. You know, we're offered what look like a range of choices, but some things are off the page. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about what an actual public health approach to, in this case, the opioid crisis would look like.
So it would have different pieces. One would be simply focusing on direct overdose prevention. Trump talks a little bit about this, but really putting resources into funding naloxone, the overdose reversal medication, at the community level, and removing bars on access to it, and focusing on reducing its price, which is a major barrier to access. So that it's not just putting it in the hands of first responders, but so that also family members and friends, people close to those who use drugs, can also have access to naloxone and use it in a timely way at the time of an overdose. Another piece of it has to do with treatment. I feel very strongly, and I would argue that it's very important that treatment be available to people who want it voluntarily. But the U.S. should not be focused on coercing people into treatment, because that tends to be ineffective. Now, for people who want it, often they can't access it. So there's a lot to be done in increasing access to treatment, including the treatment that has been proven to be most effective for opioids, which is medically assisted treatment with methadone and other medications. That's another piece of that. There's also putting resources into research and evaluating other forms of pain management, looking at medical marijuana as an option. And there are studies that suggest that states that have legalized medical marijuana, opioids are less of a problem. I would also say that we need to look at reducing harms from drug misuse, not just overdose, but infection, spread of hep C, and so on. And that means looking at supervised consumption sites, which I mentioned before, and providing free drug checking so that people who are using heroin or other drugs can get them checked to make sure that they're not contaminated with fentanyl and they won't be at as high a risk of overdose. And then the final piece of this is around education and prevention, and that means offering meaningful evidence-based education around drugs and the risks of drug misuse that go far beyond just say no.
We've been speaking with Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno. She's Executive Director of Drug Policy Alliance. They're online at drugpolicy.org. Thank you very much, Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Claiming the current system had failed too many students, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos recently announced a change in sexual assault provisions for college campuses. Guidance issued by the Obama administration had underscored that sexual harassment of students, which includes acts of sexual violence, is a form of sex discrimination prohibited by federal civil rights law Title IX. But DeVos says, quote, "Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved," close quote. Media are covering it as sort of an Obama-Trump culture war thing, but what's a better way to talk about what seems to be going on here? Alyssa Peterson is state organizer with Know Your Nine, a survivor and youth-led project that aims to empower students to end sexual and dating violence in their schools. She joins us now by phone from Connecticut. Welcome to Counterspin, Alyssa Peterson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, could you explain about this 2011, it's called a Dear Colleague letter, and the follow-up guidance that Betsy DeVos is talking about rescinding? She and her supporters call it overreach. What is their argument, and what did that letter actually say?
Betsy DeVos has absolutely misrepresented the contents of the Dear Colleague letter, which helped survivors like me access education after we were sexually assaulted on our campuses. The Dear Colleague letter, as you stated, clarified that Title IX applies to instances of sexual violence. And for people like me, it was the first time that I had heard anything more than Title IX covers women's sport. For a lot of us, it provided us with hope after we were assaulted. It helped us access the resources that we needed because the Dear Colleague letter told us that our school was required to provide us with counseling, with housing accommodations, with extensions on term papers that really helped many of us stay in school after we were assaulted. So as for her rationale, Betsy DeVos said that the guidance has failed both sides, which really has misrepresented the survivor position because for many of us, 6 or 7 years ago, our schools were not addressing this issue. The Dear Colleague letter signaled that the federal government took this issue seriously, which really helped us take that letter into meetings with our school administrators to change school policies, and we knew that the federal government had our back. And the other sort of major point that DeVos has made is that the campus process is fundamentally unfair to accused students, but every single example that she's used for that proposition, such as students not receiving notice of their hearing or survivors not being given accommodations, is in fact a violation of the guidance and of Title IX. And if she was acting in good faith, she would enforce the law, just as the Obama administration did when schools were violating the rights of accused students and survivors alike.
Well, that's what's so confusing. Certainly what you hear is that the problem that supposedly this action is going to solve is a lack of due process for people who are accused of rape. But if that's in the guidance itself, it seems like the solution would be to enforce that guidance rather than remove it.
Exactly. And Title IX actually requires schools to handle all allegations promptly and equitably. That provides the department with a lot of latitude to make sure that both survivors and accused students are being provided with process, What DeVos and her proponents want is a criminal process, which stacks the deck in favor of accused students rather than the civil rights law that Title IX actually is.
That seems to be a point that it turns on. And it's when you start talking about moving it to a criminal justice position or, you know, why don't we just call the police? Then this other thing comes in. I've seen this subtext of coverage that suggests that somehow concern for survivors of sexual assault is racist. What is that theme? What's going on there?
Yeah, no, that's a really important issue. I think, first of all, I kind of want to provide listeners with background about why Know Your Nine and other survivors use Title IX. And it's in part because Title IX affords victims rights. And sometimes those rights will, for someone to stay in school, they need their rapist removed from their campus because they can't function while he or she is there. So for that reason, Title IX does have this disciplinary component where someone can be removed from campus. The reason that Know Your Nine opts for a campus system instead of a prison system is because we believe that the prison system is fundamentally violent and racist. So we don't want to double down on that system. And we see Title IX as creating an alternative to incarceration. So then if you turn to the individuals who are alleging that the campus system is racist towards accused students are the same individuals who want to dismantle the campus system entirely. So I think the lead critic of this was Emily Yaffe, who wrote a series of very searing Atlantic articles. But when you dig into them, you realize that the data that she's relying on are a series of Google alerts that she's set, which for me should not be relied on in policymaking. We need more data than that. And Emily Yaffe has also suggested previously that survivors should be accountable for drinking when they're sexually assaulted. So she's consistently opposed the idea that schools should handle these issues at all. The other groups that have also levied this charge, as you said, support the idea that a survivor should be pushed into the criminal justice system and that schools should have no role. But I can think of nothing more racist and harmful than requiring survivors, particularly survivors of color, to go into a criminal justice system that is completely biased against them and is also biased against people who are accused of sexual assault. We are concerned that there is bias in the campus system, but we're concerned that there's bias for both survivors and accused students. And just as handle other civil rights issues, we need schools to have data, which Know Your Nine has called for schools to release aggregate data for 2 years now talking about racial impacts and discipline. And if there is a disparity, the Department of Education needs to enforce that, just like they need to end the school-to-prison pipeline in K-12 schools, just like they need to stop push out of LGBT schools. This should be considered a civil rights issue, but one that maintains the campus system and should be enforced.
Well, let me just ask you about media. The media are sort of covering it as almost like an identity politics or like a culture war debate. But I find it interesting that meanwhile, many colleges seem to be saying we're going to carry on with the guidance that we have, which suggests that outside the sort of talking heads arena, they find this Obama era guidance useful and workable.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's in part because the changes that Betsy DeVos has been pushing are very radical, that seem to presuppose that schools should not have a role in the system, are imposing a criminal-like process on universities, which they don't feel comfortable executing, whereas a civil rights role, they are feeling more comfortable in that role. And then I think the second point is schools have really invested a lot of resources into their policy. They've talked to the members of their community. They've worked with survivors to refine the policy. They don't want to throw all of that progress and work in the trash. And then also, they know that if they do try to roll back their policies that afford protections to accused students and survivors, students will rise up. And just like students have been very vigilant using the media, we are watching for any school that tries to weaken protections for survivors and accused students. They have student backlash to fear, which I think is a major reason why they're keeping their policies in place.
Well, let me ask you finally, Know Your Nine has a quite insightful, I think, journalist's guide for journalists who are covering gender-based violence and campus sexual assault. What are some of the concerns you have or thoughts you have about the way media tend to cover this set of issues? What would you like to see maybe more or less of?
I think media coverage has dramatically improved over the years. I think there are some areas of concern, which are first, there are certain survivors who are highlighted often in the media. They tend to be white women, cisgender women, And that means a lot of the stories about what people are experiencing on campus are not being told. And frankly, it has created this perception that only white women are accusers in rape context, which is just deeply untrue. And that's what journalists like Emily Yaffe have seized upon to create their narrative, which is a false one. So I think making sure that survivors of all perspectives are being represented and avoiding the kind of conflation of elite white female student who has been assaulted by an acquaintance at a fraternity party, which is sort of the dominant narrative. And then I think the other issue that I personally experienced is often a journalist will call and will ask for a survivor story. And I'm happy to talk about my experience, but the reason I do that is because it provides fodder for policy discussions. But sometimes I and other survivors have found that journalists will just truncate the policy discussion and only share the story, which is just really disempowering and not presenting the actual picture that many of the survivors have now gone to law school, we're deeply interested in policy, we've changed policy at our schools, and we're more than just sad rape girls, which is really what a lot of journalists, unfortunately, have portrayed us in the media. So I think those are sort of the two primary issues. And then I think there are other sort of stylistic things, like a lot of people have talked about the use of passive voice in talking about sexual violence, which even in the act of crafting a piece avoids accountability for the person who perpetrated the violence. There's sort of stylistic things, and then there are also choices on who's featured and in what context they're featured.
Yeah, I'd like to give actually a shout out to Robin Powell at Rewire, who talked about the impact of rescinding this guidance on students with disabilities, who are less likely to report assaults and are more likely to be sexually assaulted. So it seems that that coverage is kind of coming in, maybe not, it's not the main story, but we do have reporters out there who are trying to find the kind of underexplored angles on this story.
Exactly. That was a phenomenal piece. I'd like to give my own shout out to Anna Walsh, who is the author of The Toolkit, and she's a journalist. So we kind of intended the resource as a journalist-to-journalist guide on how to cover this issue.
All right, then. Well, we've been speaking with Alyssa Peterson. She's state organizer at Know Your Nine. You can find them online at Know Your Nine. That's knowyourix.org. Alyssa Peterson, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for a big change in sea levels? It could happen. New science says the present gradual sea level rise is not a guide to the future. Despite the models and the IPCC, during past warming events, seas rose very quickly, swamping coastal land. We could have up to 3 meters higher arrive not just this century, but any decade now. Nobody is prepared for that. Not China, the U.S., not Bangladesh, nobody. We'll explore the new warning with the lead author, Pankaj Khanna. But the sea level rise will be unevenly distributed because the land is still adjusting from the weight of massive glaciers that have disappeared now. New England shores are sinking for geologic reasons, even as the seas rise. But rising land in some parts of Alaska makes it look like sea levels are falling there. The deniers love that. Looking into the depths of the earth, we do know why. Partly due to the life work of our other guest from Canada, Dr. Richard Peltier. In the end, we will explore the big dark with rising YouTube news commentator Cenk Uygur, host of The Young Turks. We have a recording of what he says, and it's what we're all bursting to say. about the news and climate change. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Before we get to the startling news about rapid sea level change events, let's find the background on how this strange planet really works. Our first guest invented the formula that determines the relationship between glacial ice cover and sea level in any climate, including our future. Sometimes my curiosity backs me into corners much deeper than I am. Of course, that is why we call on world experts to bail us out. This time, I was reading an article in the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution, which claimed that melting glaciers are causing havoc. More perplexing, glaciers that vanished over 10,000 years ago will add to the rising seas of climate change in some places, but bring falling seas in others. Of course, that's a global denier's dream. You know, the seas are actually falling. How could Al Gore be right? But come on, does the Earth's crust have an active memory? That's what we need to know. And that was a good article by Jenny Chin that I read in September 2016. But who could straighten out those mysteries of ghost glaciers? The article points to a Canadian scientist who found a way to measure and predict all that, and we're using what he found. Dr. Richard Peltier is a man with many titles, located in Canada. He's professor of physics at the University of Toronto. Peltier is the director of the Center for Global Change Science. He has been the principal investigator of the Polar Climate Stability Network and the scientific director of something called SciNet. Peltier is a man who looks inside things like waves moving deep inside the ocean and the physics of planetary interiors. Despite his pivotal role in global research into glaciers, he prefers to be called just Dick. Dick Peltier, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to talk to you.
I appreciate your sharing this time. I really do. Let's start with New England, where we have lots of listeners. Anybody who lives near the shore there knows it's changing because the sea is rising, but it's rising faster in New England than in some other places around the world seaside. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons for this. I mean, probably the most important one is that the entire East Coast, including the New England region, is subsiding. That is, the surface of the land is sinking into the sea, not as a consequence of the action of global warming causing the expansion of ocean water and thus rising sea levels, and not because of the current continuing loss of mass from the great ice sheets at the poles, but simply because Canada, at the maximum of the last ice age, was covered by an over 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice. And while this ice was in place, it pressed the surface of the Earth down under it, and this caused the land outside of the ice-covered region to be uplifted to produce what we call a proglacial forebulge. Since this massive ice cover was lost from Canada, the Canadian landmass has been rising out of the sea, and the entire U.S. East Coast has been sinking into the sea. So a very large contribution to the rise of sea level everywhere along the U.S. East Coast, including New England, is associated with this process of what we call proglacial forebulge collapse.
Well, that's not good news for New York and New Jersey when the next storm surge comes.
No, it certainly isn't. And that region of the coast, closer probably to Baltimore, in fact, is the region where the amplitude of this proglacial forebulge was largest. And its collapse is currently contributing on the order of a millimeter per year, every year, to global sea level rise. Not associated with the ongoing process of global warming, but rather associated with the influence of the last ice age.
I don't think we're going to get too deep into this topic without learning one key phrase, which is glacial isostatic adjustment. Can you explain for the layperson what that is?
Surely. Basically, when there is a large mass of ice imposed on the surface of the planet, and I spoke earlier of this roughly 4 kilometer thickness of grounded ice that covered Canada at last glacial maximum. If this ice is resident on the surface of the planet for long enough, and here I'm speaking of times which are longer than a few thousands of years, In fact, this last ice age occurred over a time scale of 100,000 years. And given the presence of the ice, initially, the land beneath the ice is pressed downwards by a perfectly elastic effect that is an almost instantaneous reaction to the load of ice. But as this ice is continuing to reside on the surface, eventually the interior of the planet begins to flow as if it were a liquid at a rate which is determined by the effective viscosity of this solid, which is behaving as a liquid. Matter flows out from under the region that was ice-covered into the periphery, causing this four-bulge region to be elevated. When the ice disappears, the reverse process occurs. Material begins to flow back under the once ice-covered region, causing the surface of the solid Earth to be uplifted. So if you look today, for example, in the Hudson Bay region of Canada, which was near the center of ice cover during the last ice age maximum, what we observe is that sea level is actually falling in the Hudson Bay region at the rate of about 1.5 centimeters every year. Or put it another way, the land is uplifting with respect to the sea at the same rate, about 1.5 centimeters every year. This rebound effect is the effect that is associated with the glacial isostatic adjustment process.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere in Alaska, somebody managed to open up a new golf course on the foreshore because some new land appeared for them.
Well, Alaska is a little bit of a different story, in fact, because the Alaska region is one in which the sea level is very strongly affected by earthquake-related processes, right? The entire coastline of Alaska has been subjected over the past many, many thousands of years to extremely intense what we call dip-slip earthquakes, which cause a very profound response of the surface of the solid Earth with respect to the sea as well, effects which have nothing to do with the glacial isostatic adjustment process, but rather with basic seismic processes.
And what about Britain and Scandinavia? They were under heavy ice loads. Are they rising now?
Yeah, I mean, Britain and Scandinavia, very closely related processes. In fact, the northern part of Britain, Scotland, and the contiguous regions across the North Sea of Norway and Sweden, that entire region at last glacial maximum was covered by a single sheet of ice, grounded ice, that connected these regions together. The southern part of England, in fact, was not ice covered. And at that time, at glacial maximum, the entire English Channel was dry land. That is, there was a land bridge that basically connected the southern part of the UK to the continent directly.
This makes me think about Brexit not really working at that time. But anyway, all right.
No, they were even more intimately connected than they have been in the past decades.
Well, now, Dick Peltier, you solved a basic problem of mapping out how this whole legacy of past ages operates. Could you tell us as novices about your system?
Well, the methodology that I've developed to help understand the connected issues of glaciation history and relative sea level history is a mathematical problem that's actually very closely connected to issues that have been solved prior to my becoming involved in this area by seismologists who are interested in the elastic, what we call elastic gravitational free oscillations of the planet, the ringing of the Earth, if you like a bell, which is caused when a massive earthquake occurs. What I'd been able to do was to take the basic theoretical structure that has been used to explain this ringing of the Earth bell, which occurs subsequent to major earthquakes, and to recast it into a form which enables a detailed description of the variations in the shape of the Earth and the history of local sea level by solving a complicated equation that I call the sea level equation. And this was accomplished basically in the mid-70s and 80s, and since that time, the theory has become further elaborated, much more detailed, and able to explain a wide variety of different observations that are connected with the ice age related deformations of the shape of the planet that have occurred as a consequence of glacial loading and unloading. And the theory is now being applied to help us to understand the sea level history that is being caused by the global warming process as it leads to a continuous diminution of the ice cover on Greenland and Antarctica, for example. So the theory has come to have a very, very wide application.
So we can go forward and backward with it. We could also help reconstruct past climates.
Yes, in fact, one of the major applications of the theory now, and it's one which my own group is very deeply involved in, is using the theory to determine what the boundary conditions of the planet were in terms of ice cover, in terms of the varying bathymetry of the ocean that was caused by the growth of these massive land ice complexes. So what we're doing is using the theory to produce boundary conditions for times in the past that reach back through the most recent 100,000-year ice age cycle. And what we're doing is taking these boundary conditions and using them in the context of modern climate models, the same models that are used to simulate the global warming process, so that we can reconstruct what climate would have been like at these past times. And the work has led to some very, very interesting explanations for observations that had never been explained previously.
And there have been a series of reconstructions called ICE 3G up to 5G, and now I guess coming 6G.
7G was published about 3 months ago, 2 months ago.
What are they?
Well, these are basically models of the variation through time from about 30,000 years ago until the present of the changing ice cover on the planet, the changing paleotopography of the planet with respect to sea level, and the changing level of the sea everywhere throughout the global ocean basins as a function of time from about 30,000 years ago until the present. And each of these, each new edition, if you like, of the model, the global model, is driven typically by new discoveries of data that hadn't previously been assimilated into the theoretical structure. So we keep revising the model, improving the model continuously as new data become available. The recent, most recent model, the 6GC model, is basically being employed internationally now in the context of what's called the Paleoclimate Model Intercomparison Project, in which the boundary conditions that I provide are being exercised by basically all of the global climate models that are employed in making global warming predictions of our future as a means of determining how accurate these models actually are. That is, by testing them outside of the region of parameter space, we call it, outside of the region in which they've been tuned to enable them to make global warming projections. So this whole process is playing a critical role now in our understanding of the climate system as a whole.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Our guest is Professor Richard Peltier from the University of Toronto, Canada. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'd like to draw on your other research domains of climate change and the Arctic to explore what I see as a parallel problem. A few years ago, UK geohazards expert Dr. Bill McGuire published his book, Waking the Giants, and he said land rising from the weight of glaciers triggers already existing fault lines into more earthquakes or volcanoes, into eruptions. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's been a topic that's been exercised a lot over the past roughly 20 or 30 years. The notion that the rebound of the crust due to the unloading of these massive ice complexes that existed at glacial maximum could be today responsible for triggering new earthquakes. I should say that this whole topic is very seriously debated on both sides of the issue. It's proven to be very difficult to actually discover, with the possible exception of Scandinavia, of Norway and Sweden, evidence for the occurrence, unambiguous evidence for the occurrence of this deglaciation-induced seismicity idea.
Can glaciers actually sort of cap off or diminish the possibility of volcanoes that exist under the ice? We've just seen an example of one going off in Iceland, and there was a discovery recently of a chain of volcanoes under Antarctica. Is the ice a factor in suppressing those?
I think in Iceland it's quite conceivable. Again, the arguments have been presented on both sides of that issue. But clearly the Iceland case is a very, very special case because Iceland sits on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, right under a hot spot, if you like, an upwelling of hot material out of the interior of the Earth. And it gives rise, of course, to intense volcanism on Iceland episodically. You know, whether there has been any significant role played in that volcanism by variations in the ice cover over Iceland itself is really very difficult to establish in an unambiguous way.
Changing horses here. We love to watch the waves on the ocean, but you track waves that move below the surface. I didn't even know those existed. Could you tell us what's going on down there?
Well, this is an extremely interesting area, and it's one which is, in a way, closely connected as well, or at least connected, to this issue of global climate change associated with ice age processes. Let's talk just for a minute about the modern ocean and the interior wave field which exists throughout the volume of the modern ocean. That wave field, we believe, is very strongly produced, in fact triggered, by the motion of what we call the barotropic tide, the roughly 12-hour periodic tide that exists in the volume of the oceans and which corresponds to motions, horizontal motions of seawater, right down to the base of the ocean at very slow rates, but in a highly periodic fashion. So the motion of this water over bottom topography in the ocean gives rise to waves which are called inertia gravity waves. And collectively, these waves are referred to as an internal tide. So they are a consequence of the astronomically forced tide, but they constitute an addition on top of that astronomically forced tide, which consists of this family of internal waves. The interest in these waves is that when they break, and they do break rather like ocean waves on a beach, they produce a mixing of the interior fluid of the ocean. And this mixing basically affects or causes or forces a vertical flux of mass in the internal body of the major ocean basins. And it's this vertical flux of mass caused by mixing associated with breaking of the internal tide that enables the very cold, salty, deep water that forms at the poles of the planet to rise up from the interior, right, and to complete what we call the overturning circulation, meridional overturning circulation of the oceans, or MOC, M-O-C. This meridional overturning circulation of the ocean has a huge impact on climate. And so the study of this internal wave field, this field of inertia gravity waves, has come to be a very sharp focus of work in physical oceanography globally.
Well, aside from climate, I'm gathering from what you say that internal ocean waves could help feed living things if they're causing an upwelling, and also help, well, you're talking about the distribution of oceanic heat.
Yeah, the upwellings, of course, are associated with, rather than simply with the wave field in the ocean, with the nature of the circulation of the oceans itself. These upwelling zones, of course, are highly productive, and of course, when you think of the equatorial Pacific Ocean, right off the west coast of South America, for example, during El Nino Southern Oscillation events, when the upwelling of cold water adjacent to the west coast of South America basically ceases, there's a massive impact, of course, on ocean productivity locally. The Peruvian anchovy harvest, you know, is one of the things to which we, you know, typically point in looking at the way in which time variation of this component of the ocean circulation impacts ocean productivity.
Getting back to the inside of things, we walk around on the crust, that is the Earth to us. What is the mantle, and does what happens there affect us?
No, absolutely. The mantle of the planet, broadly speaking, is the region from about roughly 3,000 kilometers in depth, about halfway to the interior, to the center of the Earth, up to the surface, or up to about 100 kilometers below the surface, right? So this region is solid, whereas the core of the planet, or at least the outer core of the planet, is liquid. So this solid part of the planet is the part of the planet which is able to flow as if it were a liquid when a stress is applied to it on a sufficiently long time scale, such as during the glacial loading and unloading process. So this mantle of the Earth is the region which is probed by the glacial isostatic adjustment process. And we can use this glacial isostatic adjustment probe to determine what the effective viscosity of the interior, the solid part of the interior of the planet, is. And this is proven to be the most powerful means of our establishing quite precisely what the value of that viscosity is. Of course, the mantle is also involved, rather like the oceans, in fact, in a circulation of its own kind, right, of its own region, which is associated with the thermal convection process, the fact that the core of the Earth, again about halfway down to the center by radius, the core mantle boundary, we call it, is at a temperature of between 3,000 and 4,000 kelvins. It's extremely hot. And because the difference in temperature between that boundary and the outer boundary of the planet itself is so large, the entire mantle is caused to convect like a liquid, rather like water in a pot which is put on the stove and heated from below. So there's an intense convective circulation in the mantle that is occurring on very, very long timescales, and it's that circulation which is responsible for the continental drift process, for plate tectonics, and all of the processes that are associated with plate tectonics. So there is a very deep connection, if you like, between the glacial isostatic adjustment process and the manner in which analyzing this process enables us to infer what the effective viscosity of the mantle of the Earth is, and the mantle convection process, which to explain physically requires knowledge of the effective viscosity of the interior. In my own work has actually demonstrated that the viscosity of the mantle that we infer on the basis of glacial isostatic adjustment analysis is precisely the viscosity which is required in a theory of the mantle convection process in order to explain plate tectonics. So there's a very deep connection between these two modes of motion, if I can call them that, of the solid outer part of the planet, which we refer to as the mantle.
Do you think that climate change has already diverted what might have been the next ice age?
Well, that's also that's also a very interesting comment. Short answer is yes, probably, although the timing of what would have been the onset of the next 100,000-year ice age cycle, right, is not precisely known, even though for the last million years, this 100,000-year ice age cycle has been an almost metronomic occurrence, right, in the history of Earth's climate variability. The magnitude of carbon dioxide that we've released into the atmosphere since the beginning of Northern Hemisphere industrialization is sufficiently strong, even now, to have strongly inhibited any tendency of this 100,000-year ice age cycle to continue. And so the probability of its continuation, given the continuing rise of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, very highly unlikely.
Dick Peltier, from your long career studying multiple fields, what concerns you most about our future?
Well, I mean, I think the concern we all have for the impact on planetary habitability that's associated with the global warming process that's caused by greenhouse gas increase is probably the greatest challenge that human civilization has faced since its rapid evolution, beginning probably around the middle of the last of these 100,000-year ice age cycles. This is an absolutely crucial issue which the global political system has yet been unable to come together to formulate a clear collective response. And I'm saying this even in the face of the Paris Climate Accord that was signed in late 2015. It's beginning to look as though the possibility that we will live up to the commitments under the Paris Accord are highly in doubt. And this is a huge concern to all of us who, you know, have a genuine desire to see to the continuing viability of human habitation. This is a huge concern to us all, whether the international community will ever be able to come together to take the collective action that's needed is highly questionable at present.
You know, there are some scientists who suggest that geoengineering could preserve what's left of the Arctic ice cap, and that might be necessary to preserve a livable climate. I'm not so sure. I am sort of a doomster. I think we're headed into that ice-free state that Earth has had for many millions of years in the past.
Well, you know, there was an interesting CBC piece done last night, actually, on the news on exactly this issue of geoengineering. The difficulty with all of the several different geoengineering solutions that have been suggested is that they normally would involve a catastrophe should they fail. And the probability of failure for any one of these geoengineering solutions, I would argue, is extremely high. So there's no answer from my own perspective to the problem of what we should do other than beginning to take dramatic steps to curtail greenhouse gas emissions. I'm very, very dubious that any of the geoengineering solutions that have been suggested could ever work.
What should science undergrads look for as the next important research frontier?
Oh, dear. Now, that's a very broad question. Well, this area, I think, is one that is going to continue to attract scientific attention of many of the brightest young people that are considering careers in science. But in the general area of the overall area of scientific research, of course, there are many different avenues of development which are occurring simultaneously, you know, including deep learning and its application basically to all areas of science, including the environment.
We've been speaking with Dr. Richard Peltier, professor of physics at the University of Toronto and head of other scientific initiatives. His system of measuring deglaciation and its impact is used by scientific bodies all over the world. Find links to follow up further in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dick, thank you so much for educating us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Now we will hear the news that governments, the public, and most scientists, really, have not yet digested. Sea level does not creep up regularly, as shown on all our charts. During warming, it can rise rapidly in steps. Steps that could easily displace hundreds of millions of people in a few decades and rearrange the world as we know it. Over the past few centuries, humans have recorded a predictable and relatively gradual rise of the oceans. But a new study from scientists at Rice University warned that isn't how climate change worked in the past. Mapping out extinct coral reefs off the coast of Texas revealed a warning. Seas can and do rise in sudden steps. I remember Dr. James Hansen told us we could see up to 3 meters of sea level rise by the end of this century, and I don't have to tell you what that means for global cities built on coastlines or the human project in general. But how do we know this can happen or that it has happened? Pankaj Khanna is the lead author of a paper published in Nature Communications on October 19, 2017. The title is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation. Pankaj got his master's at the University of New Delhi before traveling to Rice University in Texas for his PhD. He has worked extensively there with Professor Andre W. Droxler. From Houston, Texas, Pankaj Khanna, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. So, as a beginning, how can coral drown?
Sure. The corals, the way they work is they need specific parameters to grow. And they need specific lat and longe, which is like they usually grow between 30 degrees north and south. And they need certain salinity conditions, water temperature conditions. And then the most important one is the sea level, the closeness to the sea level. So they like to grow with the sea level. Now, if something happens due to which there is a sudden rapid rise in sea level, such that the rate of rise is faster than the growth rate of the coral reefs, then they can drown.
By drowning, really, doesn't it mean that they're getting below the level of light that they need in order to keep going?
Well, yes. But if you see, the photic zone is 100 meters, or it varies around the ocean. And these reefs, where they want to grow is around like 5 meters or 5 to 10 meters of water depth. So they want to grow in like very, very shallow water depths. And the sunlight can reach much, much lower than that, but the conditions aren't good enough for them to grow if they are like below certain water depth.
Last June, we had coral expert Charlie Varon on Radio EcoShock, and he talked about past extinction events for coral over the half billion years of their time on Earth. But when discussing climate change impacts, Dr. Varon emphasized ocean acidification and ocean temperatures too high for the codependent organisms. Why does your paper point to rising seas as a driver of coral extinction during warming events?
Sure. So this paper is talking about the last deglaciation. And by last deglaciation, I mean last 20,000 years, during which the sea level has risen up to 120 meters. So in general, if you see, there are cycles, cyclicity in the way the glaciers melt and the sea level increases. And it is 120 meters in every around 100,000 years, since like past several thousand years. So what has happened is, within the last 20,000 years, the sea level has risen, so it is a warming world. So now, how did the sea level rose in the warming world is exactly what has been pointed out in this study. And why we are saying it's more ocean rises, because there are like some spectacular morphologies, which are called as terraces, and have been observed on all of these reefs. So there are around 10 reefs, around 1 to 2 square kilometers in their size, and around 120 kilometers apart on South Texas shelf. And they've recorded 6 terraces, which can be mapped on each of these reefs. And the way we define a terrace is a flat area bounded by steep slopes. So now we have all of these terraces on all of these reefs. The question was how you can form these terraces. And the only way to form terraces is, in our specific study, is by sudden or rapid sea level rise events. And that's why we are saying it's because of the rapid sea level rise events that these reef morphologies were modified. And at a certain point, all of these reefs just died together. And it was around 12,000 years before present.
Well, let's get on board the research ship Falkor, operating off the Texas coast. Tell us about that ship.
Sure. So it's owned by Schmidt Ocean Institute, which is owned by a former Google owner, Mr. Eric Schmidt. And this was the third expedition of this ship, and it was a test expedition. And we went into Gulf of Mexico on this ship with biologists from Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Now, this ship is equipped with latest multi-beam sonar, with which you can get a resolution greater than half a meter in resolution. And then you can also have, we call it seismic data, shallow seismic data. So we can actually look below the Earth up to around 40 to 50 meters, what's present below the surface of the seafloor. And then there were like several other equipments which were utilized by biologists to understand the biology which is now present on these reefs.
Now, I know this is a stupid question, but how do you know you were looking at coral and not just plateaus of the ocean bottom?
Well, this is a perfect question because you have to know the geological history. So what we geologists do is we try to understand the origin of the system, the growth of the system, and then demise together. So the way it all started was, like, you can actually see that around 3,000 square kilometers of seismic data, sub-seafloor data, was collected on South Texas shelf within the last 20 to 30 years. At the same time, my advisor, Professor Droxler, was already conducting research on these reefs on South Texas shelf. Now, before my advisor started in 1990s, already in 1970s, there were researchers who went down there on some smaller submarines and collected some data, and they found coral rubble on top of these banks. And then they also found a lot of morphologies which are only found on coral reefs, on modern coral reefs in Caribbean. And that's how we kind of came to an idea that these reefs could be coralgal in origin. The next thing is that these reefs haven't been drilled. These reefs have never been drilled. Only whatever data has been collected is just a kind of grab sample. You just go on top, collect some sample, and come back. And so it has been a big mystery. But if you see on Texas shelf, there are modern reefs called as flower garden banks. And those reefs are coralgal reefs growing right now in the modern ocean, and they are made up by coral species such as Acropora palmata, Acropora cervicornis, which are the major framework reef builders in the Caribbean right now. So now the question is, if the flower garden banks can have these coral species, what species will our banks have? And that's how getting the analogy from these flower garden banks, which are a little bit east of our location, we kind of came to a conclusion that our reefs were built by major framework building corals, such as Acropora palmata and cervicornis. And it's mostly because these reefs, first of all, grew 40 to 50 meters in less than 8,000 years. And then second, the proximity of other modern coral reefs having these species.
So that 40 to 50 meters is vertical growth, I'm presuming?
Yes. But that vertical growth, 40 to 50 meters, now is buried. Half of it is now being buried by the sediments which come from rivers. And these days, a lot of sediment is, as you can see on Google Earth or Google Maps, there are a lot of sediments of siliciclastic origin coming into the ocean and which are now burying these reefs, and these reefs are only partially exposed now. And it's around 20 to 25 meters which is currently exposed on the seafloor.
Now, I was reading in the paper about the concept of coral backstepping as a response to warming periods, and it seems like each of the new steps is smaller than the previous plateau below it. Is that because they're putting so much energy trying to go up rather than out, or why does that happen?
Yes. So this is a phenomena which is caused due to stress on the system. And the stress in this situation is caused by rapid sea level rise events. So as soon as the sea level rises, the reefs are put under stress and they shrink. And the way they shrink is they backstep. And this methodology or this way backstepping kind of produces terraces on these reefs. And what has happened is through time, since the reef started growing, there were these rapid events which were being recorded in the morphology of these reefs. And like every other terrace as it was formed, kind of caused the reefs to shrink up to a point of time when there was no surface area left to shrink, and all of these reefs died, and all of these reefs are currently preserved around 60 meters below sea level.
And when did that happen? When was their final demise, if you want to call it that?
Around 12,000 years ago before present.
Okay. Now, as it happens, I just interviewed Dr. Richard Peltier from the University of Toronto, and it's my understanding that he created a math formula to determine the relationship between the amount of ice on land and sea level. Did that play in any way into your research method?
No, not that. But what played an important role in our research is to compare these reef high-resolution reef terrace record to high-resolution climate record, which is available through Greenland Ice Cores, and it's called as a Greenland Ice Core Project, in which people studied the ice cores to understand the climate during the time period of the whole last deglaciation. So by looking at that climate record, we were able to now compare these reef terraces to the warming periods which are now present in that climate record.
And you also worked on a paper about coral in the Indian Ocean. Can you talk about how coral history there compares to what was found off Texas?
Definitely. So in the Indian Ocean, I'm working in Maldives. And in Maldives, what we are trying to do is to compare different terraces on different atolls. And also we have some multi-beam data around Malay Island, the capital of the country, Maldives. And there the idea was to compare scuba diving transects with the multi-beam data which we have of Malay Island. And what we see there is you do not find very high resolution terrace record as we find in on South Texas shelf. So there, what is preserved is we do see terraces. There are about 9 of those terraces, but those 9 terraces are from the depth of 120 meters to zero water depth. And the reefs on the South Texas shelf, there are 6 terraces within about 95 to like 60 meters of water depth. So you can see already just within 35 meters, there are 6 terraces which are very, very high resolution on South Texas shelf. But in the Malay Island, the story is very different.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my guest, Pankaj Khanna from Rice University in Texas. We're talking about new science showing sea level can go up in bursts during climate change. Well, now to a hard part. It's my understanding we don't have sea level records for periods shorter than about 1,000 years. And without that certain dating, how can your team discover sea level changes that might have happened within 100 years, such a long time ago?
Yes, you're absolutely right. But there are records of up to a few centuries which show dramatic rise in sea level called as meltwater pulses. So the ones which are most famous are Meltwater Pulse 1A and Meltwater Pulse 1B. And within a few centuries, like 200 to 300 years, the sea level rose up to 15 to 20 meters during that time period, with the sea level rise rate as fast as 40 millimeters per year. And if you see the sea level rise rate today, it's only 3 millimeters per year. So what we knew was that sea level could rise up to 40 millimeters per year during the last deglaciation, and it has been dated. In our case, we do not have any of the dated material. So what we did, we came up with a model, age model, which we derived from the current terrace depths, as well as the glacial isostatic adjustment. This is a correction which is required to be made due to melting of the glaciers. And the third thing is subsidence. So how much the land has subsided since the initiation of these reefs on South Texas shelf. So using all of these parameters and putting it all together, we came up with the age model of the start of the reef and the end of the reef, and also for all of these terraces. Now, the interesting thing to see is if you see the climate record on the Greenland ice core, there are about 5 to 6 warming events which match really well to our terraces. And that kind of, you know, gives you already an idea that these kind of events were existing. Right now, we do not have the exact age or amplitude of all these terraces, but we have very clear idea that if you go now with a ship and drill these reefs and date them, you will find the exact amplitude and the timing of these terraces and which would come from a decade to a century.
If I read the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it predicts a gradual but relentless rise in sea levels from 1 to 3 meters perhaps in this century, depending on what we do about carbon pollution. What are you describing? I mean, if we were to see such an event happen, say in 2050 or something, what could happen?
Well, we are not prepared for that. And what would happen is, like, there will be a dramatic rise in sea level. And no model has taken into account these kind of events that our paper is showcasing. So the idea now is that all the future predictions need to incorporate part of this study, and this kind of study that we have conducted, it's first of its kind. It's needed to be replicated in other parts of the world, and we need to prepare for that, because if you imagine, like, within like a decade or two, if the sea level rises up to a meter, that will be devastating, because we are only preparing until like 2100, like the start of the 22nd century, that is like a sea level rise from 2 to 3 meters. But if it happens way earlier, then that would be devastating for the coastal areas all around the world.
Right. We'd have to basically evacuate some coastal cities which have hundreds of millions of people living in them, and we don't know what would happen to the world economy. So it's a pretty important question that you're working on.
Yes, it surely is.
Are you aware of any proof or reasons why we should believe that just because this has happened in the past when you studied that it could happen again?
Well, yes. First of all, if you look at the reports, like for future predictions, the sea level is supposed to rise, yes? And if we go, like the geologists, the way geology works is, in general, like we say, present is the key to the past. But in this case, you know, we have understanding of the present, how fast the sea levels are rising. We now are having more understanding of the past, how sea level rose in the past. So we have to use the modern understanding and the past understanding to predict the future.
Well, I was asking about, do we have any real proof or indicators that what happened in the past could happen again in the future?
The proof is that we had a warming world during the last deglaciation, which is 20,000 years. So the Earth has been warming, and right now we're also warming the Earth at the same magnitude, which would cause the sea level to rise for sure. And to understand how the sea level would rise is very important. But if you look at the past geological record, we know that around 120,000 years before present right now, the sea level were at least 3 to 5 meters higher than the present sea level that we have. So we have the understanding of how much the cyclicity of the sea level varies. We know how much, like, how the sea level has risen in the past. We have to utilize all of this understanding for future predictions.
Now, according to the paper, sea levels rose pretty rapidly, and then they paused for a while, and then they took another big step. Do we know why?
Yes, this is most likely due to ice stream or ice sheet collapses. So if you see Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, what you see there are like big icebergs falling off, and like ice sheets are collapsing. And you can imagine if big chunk of the ice sheet collapses suddenly, then the sea level would rise very, very sharply. During that time period, the sea level would be fast. And during the other time period, when the sea level rises, the ice sheets are melting only gradually without like major ice sheet collapses. That's the time period when the sea level is only rising very, very slowly or gradually.
Well, we have a huge risk here to massive deltas where agriculture is important in many countries, to low-lying countries like Bangladesh and the Netherlands. So I'm wondering, where does this science of sea level rise need to go next?
The next would be to prepare for the possible inundation due to sea level rise. And that would be to understand how fast an area like Bangladesh or Netherlands are subsiding in comparison to the sea level rise to get better estimates. And I would say that they need to start preparing now for the future, because we do not have the understanding yet of how soon that devastating future can come. So we need to start preparing now.
We've been discussing new science on what at least five levels of extinct coral reefs can tell us about the way sea level happens during climate change. Our guest is the lead author of that study, Pankaj Khanna, from Rice University in Houston, Texas. The paper is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation, as published in Nature Communications. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pankaj, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I think that's science that needs to get out there fast. You can find links to my interview with Pankaj Khanna in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Please repost, retweet, do what you gotta do to rethink and react to a coming rapid sea level change. Recently, a massive atmospheric river covered the Pacific Ocean from Asia to North America. It was a line of storms seldom seen. TV weather forecasters were mystified. What could it be? Here is Cenk Uygur, host of The Young Turks.
Well, we've been telling you a lot about strange weather events. It's almost as if someone or a whole set of folks predicted this, maybe a whole category of profession called scientists. Well, we got hit by hurricane after hurricane. We got the droughts that led to the terrible wildfires in western United States. And now we have what is being called an atmospheric river. What in the world does that mean? Well, you're about to see. It is a 5,000-mile long belt of rain. What in the world? Let me show it to you. It stretches from China to the United States. It is a 5,000-mile belt of storms. What have we done to the planet? They have these both cool and scary phrases for this. It's also called rivers in the sky, because it's so long, and it's obviously rain and moisture in the air, and so intense that it has formed a river in the sky. Oh my God, what have we done? So now, this is not the first time that we've had this. There was one back in 2009. It is not a sign of good things to come if we start to have these more frequently and more intensely. I don't know how that it could get more intense than a 5,000-mile belt of storms, but this is picking up momentum, man. Yes, climate change makes a difference. Yes, they told you that the warm air would pick up moisture from both the ground, causing droughts and wildfires, and from the ocean, and it would create bigger storms. How's a 5,000-mile storm for you? Another thing that scientists that are tracking this call this is the big dark. Because for 5,000 miles, there's nothing but clouds in that belt, and it's the big dark, and it is headed in our direction. Well, it's already hit the state of Washington. Let me tell you about that. At least one city in Washington set a daily record for precipitation Wednesday, and Seattle was expected to have its wettest 24-hour period since February. Think about that for a second. It's not like the state of Washington isn't already wet. It's known in America as the wettest area in America. It rains all the time. We just broke a record in the state of Washington for precipitation. Gee, I wonder if there's something going on here. I wonder if the scientists were all right
that we are going to have more precipitation and more storms. More from the state of Washington. Strong wind gusts knocked out power to more than 54,000 people in western Washington. And a ground delay was temporarily placed at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. According to King 5 TV, ferry services were temporarily closed as well. Look, the stories that I'm reading, I don't know if they're afraid to make the connection. Will they seem non-neutral? Do they need to have 17 scientists on the record to talk about it? But not a lot of talk of climate change. I am not afraid to talk about it. I can see it with my own eyes. The scientists predicted that we would have massive storms. Now we have 5,000 miles of storms, the big dark. And people are wondering, oh, well, you know, that might be a shame if climate change happens later. Son, you're in climate change. You're in it right now. What more do you need? Do you need a 10,000 mile storm? We had how many hurricanes hit? Harvey, Irma, Maria. And those are the ones that just happened to hit U.S. territories. And then the wildfires that was raged for months in Montana, let alone the devastation they did in California, and now the big dark. Yes, it's climate change. Not one storm or weather pattern can be directly connected. And you say, okay, well, it rained today, it must be because of climate change. No, but overall, when you look at the macro picture and you see the intensity of these storms, it is exactly what was predicted. In fact, it is coming quicker, heavier, and much more intense than even scientists expected. Become a member of the Young Turks. TYTnetwork.com.
TYTnetwork.com bills itself as the largest online news show in the world. Cenk Uygur is the reason, I'm sure, and it's partly why I check their show, The Young Turks, out on a regular basis. Find links for that video in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening this week, and my thanks to everyone who supports this show. Please tell your friends and your electronic friends about Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Phil Taylor, and this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I believe we have Tabitha Guija on the line. Are you there, Tabitha? Hello? I think she might be there. Are you there, Tabitha?
Yes, I am.
Oh,
hello.
This is just my day for stepping on my own feet. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry we're getting to you in a different schedule, but that's all my own errors. And Tabitha, you recently were in Montreal to receive an award on behalf of your, on behalf of your niece, Diane Shima Wigara. And that was, the award was in the name of Victoire Ingabire, who was a presidential candidate and who was put in prison. And now, if I understand rightly, Diane Shima Wigara is in prison. And not only her, but another of your, a second niece of yours, and also your sister. Is that right?
Yes, it is right. Yes.
What is your reaction? You must have, your speech to those in Montreal, that's quite a meeting of people who supported both Victoire Ingabire and Diane Wigara. What were your thoughts that night?
That night, it was beautiful. And these two women, they are women of character. Mm-hmm. These women, Victoire Umuhoza Ingabire and Diane Shima Wigara, one Hutu, another, and the other Tutsi, both with a message at different times, daring to do what no other Rwandan is daring to do or say, and that is no to Kagame, no to dictatorship, no to continuously killing and ordering the disappearing of innocent Rwandans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I was just to follow on that. Could you tell us? I mean, what was it, have they yet told Diane and the others why they have been removed from their home and put in prison? Is this We see publicity, but what are the facts around this matter?
Both these women, both Diane Simar Rivera and Victor Ngabire Umuhoza, are today in prison, as you said, because they want to claim their rights and those of Rwandan people to freely express themselves and have a say and contribute in making Rwanda and a more democratic country. The injustice these women have endured, along with their families, should, you know, alarm the world that they cannot allow this to take a place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I can continue.
Sure.
Canadians need to stand up for these brave women. And see that the Rwanda is led by a dictatorship, a dictator. Mm-hmm. There is a dictatorship in Rwanda and led by a dictator.
Mm-hmm. And the remarkable thing, we really need to praise the courage and of both these women, that, because there have been challenges before, political challenges, but they were always, they had been by people who were in the diaspora living abroad. I think of Faustin Toguri Mungu, for example. But this time, it is inside the country. And what motivated, gives a strength to Diane and her family, for example? What caused them to come forward inside Rwanda?
Inside of Rwanda. Before I go into Diane Shimanzara and the family's story, I would like to say something again about these two women. It was very good and honorable for these women to be recognized for their unselfish willingness to fight for Rwandan people. And before I go to the other, you know, talking about Diane and her family, I would like to take this opportunity once again, even though I did in Montreal, to thank the organization Réseau International des Femmes pour la Démocratie et la Paix for giving them this award. Mm-hmm. Now they have to be supported more than ever before, so that, you know, what they have begun continues to show the world, the whole world, that Rwanda needs a change.
Mm-hmm. Please continue. I'm sorry.
I don't know if you want me to talk about Diane and her family story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. She
it's
lost.
Long story, but yes.
Yeah, she lost her father in an assassination. That at least the family alleged that. What was that? Had to be a crucial moment. Who was her father, and what happened there?
Yes, thank you for asking me that question. On February 4th, 2017, Rwigara Assinapol, that's Diane Sima's father, was assassinated by the President Paul Kagame's regime in the city of Kigali, country of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. This assassination was designed by the President's regime to look like it was an accident.
Mm-hmm.
By the time Assinapol was still alive, his wife, Adeline, and his daughter, Anne, arrived at the scene. At that time, the police officers began to prepare the body bag.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they knew, knowing that he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Adeline and Anne, that's the second daughter of Assinapol Rwigara, Anne, they were begging that he may be taken to the hospital. But the policemen, they refused. Instead, he was taken to the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
On the way, going there, they finished him by stabbing him in the back of the head. Mm-hmm. After he died, as you know, if taking the father, a husband of the family was not enough, they began destroy everything he had worked for, demolished the hotel, and took everything in it, closed all family businesses, which included two factories, closed all accounts, and took all money they can find.
Extraordinary. So after that, it's extraordinary use of power. I mean, there's no litigation and court orders. It was simply they just did it?
Whatsoever. None whatsoever. So on May 3rd, 2017, that's when Diane Shimar Wigara announced her plan to run for the presidency. Right? She had all right to do it. She's Rwandan, you know.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the government made it impossible for her. In the end, they made sure that she was not eligible to officially become a candidate while they used false information.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever was involved in her campaign was getting in trouble. Some of them were getting bitten, and others were simply disappearing. Diane complained so many times to the police. But of course, nothing was done about it.
Yes.
And even after, sure.
No, go
even
ahead.
Even after, yes, thank you. Even after she was told that she cannot run for the presidency, the harassment did not end. Little did they know, it was just the beginning. Mm-hmm. A month after the election of the president, which happened on August 4th, 2017, the police broke into the house, put them in handcuffs, destroyed all their belongings, took their phones, computers, and all documents. Let me tell you, it has been a living nightmare for the entire family since that day.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I mean, the comments made by Diane and her mother pointed out that this is a leader, maximum leader, Paul Kagame, who told the world that he won 98% of the vote. And wasn't it Dion said, if you have 98% of the vote, why are you afraid of me?
That's exactly right. It's just, it doesn't make sense. They won 99%, but still, they went after Diane. It did not make sense at all. So Diane, her sister Anne, and the mother, Adeline, had been detained. Can you believe that? Had been detained, living in very, very bad conditions. First week, where they have been held, they did not eat, drink, or have medical attention that they needed. For what, really? For what? After they went through their phone, they took a private conversation. It happened between family members, including myself. Including myself, because I was talking to my sister, Adeline.
So they taped the conversation and played it publicly.
And they played it, exactly. So they used them to fabricate false accusations that later on were brought into the courtroom, you know? So after a month of unfair trial, although Anne and Adeline, her mother, share almost exactly the same charges, But Anne's sister was the only one to be released today. They released Anne, not Adeline.
Isn't she the one that's an American citizen?
Yes, Anne, she's the one who has American citizenship. Yeah. Mm. Yes. Well, listen, I thank God for the release of my niece Anne, but I am asking the government of Rwanda, specifically President Paul Kagame, to release Adeline and Diane Shimazigara, because he knows, seriously, he knows deep down that they are innocent.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're guilty of wanting democracy.
That's it.
This is Tabitha Gwiza. She is the aunt of Diane Shimawigara, the presidential candidate, now imprisoned with her mother. Isn't one of the features of you, the present effort that you are making and others that probably upsets the leader, Paul Kagame, is that your family is Tutsi family, and that the family and of Victoire Ingabire is Hutu, which, according to Paul Kagame, this is not possible.
It's not possible.
And not something he wants to see.
Yes, that's exactly right, because it looks like he doesn't want the Tutsis and the Hutus to be together. He's the one who is always divided people, you know, make decisions in between people. Mm-hmm. So to me, if you allow me to continue.
Please.
In 1994, a genocide against Tutsis happened, and the world was watching and did not do anything about it. At that time, I was terrified. But today, I feel the same pain I did then, because similar to the tragedy 23 years ago. People are being killed. And yet, again, the world is watching silently.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it felt to me, it felt as though the genocide never came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
well,
go ahead.
Yes, it's continued into Congo, and hundreds of thousands lost their lives in the Congo, and it's never discussed here. Now, it is a fact that Paul Kagame's way of holding on to power is to say that he saved the country and that he is above any, he's as pure as a driven snow. But that his role now is the many questioned his own behavior and causing the loss of lives of Rwandans. What do you think of that?
I think you were right. He claimed that he's the one who stopped the genocide. But since then, people have been dying here and there. So to me, that's what I was just telling you, that I feel like genocide never came to the end, because people are still dying even now after 23 years.
Yes. I know that Philip Rentschens, the Belgian right, author, legal expert, he testified in Tanzania, and he said in court, he said the genocide actually didn't end. It simply changed the forces committing genocide. Now we have a situation where at least this might be brought to light or talked about, because we have two wonderful young women. We have Victoire Ingabire and Diane Shimawigara. And the fact that you had the meeting in Montreal and that the award was, you were able to accept that on behalf of Diane, and that's really very impressive.
Oh, yes. It was great. I was telling these women who did it, that actually we should give them a word too, because what they are doing is beautiful. It's just the, you know, to just to make well, that
well, the Canadian
to recognize these women.
Yes. The Europeans and the other Africans and Canada should take note that there is an actual struggle for democracy and peace being led by a Hutu and a Tutsi women. Absolutely remarkable.
Absolutely.
Tabitha, it's been great to talk to you. I hope we can call you again, because this obviously, this case is only just now beginning to unfold, right? I mean, there's they are in custody. There's been no, there's no trial as yet. We don't even actually know the charges, I don't believe. So I hope we can call you again, and you can tell us how it is developing. And of course, we all hope that both these women are released soon.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me. And you can call me anytime, and I'll be so happy to talk to you and tell you what's going on again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Tabitha Guiza. And again, I apologize for the peculiar beginning. I had my notes backwards, so I had the wrong person. I gave Carol a heart attack. Right? She said, just fainted in her chair, and I don't blame her. This is CIUT, the Tato Report, and 89.5 FM, November 13th. Lucky day. We're going to be on the air, and but this is your early bird update, because it's hashtag sound of your city, sound of your city. And you can start to contribute now, and you can get in on this chance to go to Iceland. And as I said, our goal is 60,000. The first person gives us 60,000. I guarantee you're going to go to Iceland. And the entire staff here will pray for your immortal remains too. There's also, well, and you can catch us on Facebook.com/The Taylor Report and SoundCloud.com /Taylor-Report.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adele Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect, who examines the significance of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's indictments of key Trump advisors and the likely political response in the Republican-controlled Congress. Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the winners and losers in the GOP tax reform plan and the real-world track record, which proves that trickle-down economics is a lie. And Yannick Joseph of the Haiti Renaissance Institute, who advocates the establishment of a national forestry corps to address Haiti's deforestation and soil erosion problem. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two months after the Burmese army launched brutal attacks against Rohingya Muslim villages in retaliation for insurgent attacks, the United States is ending its military assistance to Myanmar. Since the attacks, over 600,000 refugees have fled to Bangladesh, triggering an international humanitarian crisis. Facing growing calls in Congress for economic sanctions against Myanmar, the State Department has rescinded invitations for senior security forces from Myanmar to attend U.S.-sponsored events and has announced that officers involved in what many observers believed are ethnic cleansing operations against the Rohingya are now ineligible for U.S. assistance. According to the Associated Press, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has blamed the ethnic violence on Myanmar's army, but did not blame the Southeast Asian nation's top civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has remained virtually silent about the atrocities. President Trump, who will be taking his first trip to Asia in early November to attend the Regional Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit in the Philippines, has not yet publicly condemned the military's brutal repression against the Rohingya. Virginia's influential African-American vote could swing the state's very tight governor's race between Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, and former National Republican Party Committee Chair Ed Gillespie. The Virginia race is seen by many observers as a bellwether of the popularity of Donald Trump's presidency. Two liberal groups, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and the Michael Bloomberg-funded group Every Town for Gun Safety Action Fund, are spending tens of millions of dollars to boost black turnout in the governor's race, a critical constituency in a low-turnout off-year election. In recent days, Trump tweeted his support for Gillespie, declaring he would, quote, save our great statues slash heritage, referring to pro-slavery Confederate monuments. Thus far, Gillespie has refused to condemn the white nationalists and neo-Nazis who descended on Charlottesville this summer, which resulted in the murder of an anti-fascist activist. Meanwhile, The Nation magazine reports that the National and Virginia Democratic Party organizations have spent most of their ad dollars targeting white middle-class voters. Now, without a broad-based mobilization of African Americans, Democrats in Virginia risk losing a winnable race. In New Orleans criminal court, arrestees in orange jumpsuits wait to be heard by Magistrate Judge John Cantrell. Those appearing in court face charges ranging from drug possession to domestic violence and car theft. Judge Cantrell has a lot of discretion in granting bail, but he rarely releases a prisoner without imposing a $2,500 bond. The bail imposed, unaffordable to most poor defendants, forces many to sit in jail for months awaiting trial. Nationally, most people charged with a felony are required to post $10,000 in bail. Often, defendants and their families must rely on bail bondsmen, who typically charge about 10% of the full bail amount to act as a guarantee or surety for the rest. If the defendant can't afford the bondsman's fee up front, many bond companies will set up an installment plan and charge interest, money that will never be refunded to the defendant, regardless of the outcome of the case. Anyone who can't afford to pay a bail bondsman will sit in jail until his or her trial ends. 70% of local jail inmates are in pretrial detention status, a major reason the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Over the past 25 years, there have been numerous attempts to reform the bail system. In the early 1990s, Washington, D.C. passed a law to end bail. 3 years ago, New Jersey released arrestees unless they posed a risk to public safety. Within 6 months, the number of those in jail awaiting trial fell by one-third. Connecticut passed similar reforms earlier this year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The first indictments from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into allegations that the Trump presidential campaign colluded with the Russian government were announced on the morning of October 30th. Former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and his former business partner Rick Gates were indicted on 12 counts, including conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, operating as an unregistered agent of a foreign principal, and making false and misleading statements. Prosecutors say Manafort laundered more than $18 million from overseas accounts. Manafort and Gates, who both entered not guilty pleas, posted $10 million and $5 million bonds respectively and were placed under house arrest. Possibly more significant is the revelation that former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos had pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian officials. There's speculation that Papadopoulos, who had been cooperating with investigators since his secret arrest in July, could have been wearing a wire to record conversations with Trump insiders. Your reporter spoke with Adele M. Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect, who examines the importance of the Mueller indictments and the likely political response in the Republican-controlled Congress.
The situation with this guy Papadopoulos, who I think is a new name to most of us, is really intriguing because this was a low-level guy who was on Trump's foreign policy advisory team, but who seems to have, you know, little foreign policy experience except for having been part of a model UN program in college. But he's offering to set up meetings for the campaign while he was on the campaign with Russians who are ostensibly close to Putin, at one point even saying he thought he could get a meeting with Putin himself, you know, on behalf of the Trump campaign. It turns out that the FBI did interview him back in January, and Papadopoulos apparently lied to them, lied to the FBI. So he winds up getting arrested, but they keep his indictment under seal until now. And so there's a lot of scuttlebutt that they kept him working for the government, you know, as an informant in the months intervening. And if that's the case, who knows what Mueller has right now, if this guy wore a wire or he had face-to-face meetings with people from the campaign staff that he had worked with and got admissions from them or whatever. So it's really kind of impossible to know exactly where this investigation is right now. But by the hysteria that we see on Twitter coming from the president himself, one might think that the president's a little nervous.
I wanted to ask you about something that has been roiling around for quite some time, and that is since Donald Trump pardoned Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona, there's been a lot of speculation that if Trump insiders are indicted and face prison time, that Donald Trump will offer pardons to those folks, which certainly could unravel a trial and the case against Trump and his campaign. There's other speculation that state charges, which are not susceptible to presidential pardons at the federal level, might take the place of the leverage over some of those who are indicted
right
in the near term. What's your feeling about this power the president has to pardon and how it may affect this case?
It is troubling, right, especially given this president, this particular president. And not that I would want to see the power of the pardon removed from the presidency. I'm not saying that. But in the hands of this particular president, under these particular circumstances, it is troubling. It doesn't necessarily upend the case per se, Scott, because the pardon is a pardon of a sentence, right? It's not a pardon from the crime. And that's what we saw with Arpaio, that, okay, so he doesn't go to prison, but he's still convicted. So what you can wind up with is an exposure of what happened, but then nobody goes to jail for it, right? Or nobody goes to federal prison. In terms of the issue that you wisely bring up about what states can prosecute and that which are immune, the president cannot pardon somebody convicted on state charges. That is really particularly interesting in this case of the Trump-Russia collusion. So it's unlikely that a state can nail a campaign for colluding with a foreign power. That would be, for the most part, federal charges. But they can be charged for financial crimes. So, yes, you're quite right that is, you know, one way that this could go. I mean, the Republicans are just not standing up to any of this. And it doesn't seem like any of the Democrats who are vying for positioning themselves for 2020 presidential run are really going hard after the Republicans either.
In terms of where this investigation may go eventually, if Robert Mueller puts together a case that really implicates Donald Trump directly but doesn't charge him with a crime, it really falls to Congress, the House and the Senate both, to engage in impeachment proceedings. It seems like the Republican-controlled House and Senate aren't going to even go there. What's your speculation? If Donald Trump is indeed implicated, what do you think the response of the Republican Congress is going to be?
Well, I think there's a lot of variables, Scott. And one is how close to implication or implicated is Mike Pence. And I think that will be a factor. Now, Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, led the transition. He was warned about retired General Mike Flynn's lobbying on behalf of the government of Turkey. You know, so Pence, not pure in any of this, although he presents himself as. And now, if there's anything that implicates him in a way that would be damaging to him, I don't think that we'll see articles of impeachment ever come out of the House of Representatives. I do think there's a slim chance they could come out of the House of Representatives, and that's the body that has to, from which they have to emanate if they're to happen. If they think Pence has gotten off, that he's not implicated, because here's the thing. You know who owns the Congress? I know you know this, and I know your listeners know this. The Koch brothers own the Congress, and Mike Pence owes his career to the Koch brothers, and they're very, very keen on him. So I really think there's a chance that Donald Trump really doesn't even want this tax reform bill, because if it goes through, he's in much greater risk of articles of impeachment being drawn up against him, because he is only president so long as the Koch brothers say he is, because of the power they hold in the House of Representatives.
That was Adele M. Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect and winner of the 2017 Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Find links to more analysis of the recent Trump team indictments and Stan's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Republican-controlled U.S. House and Senate narrowly approved a joint budget resolution on October 26th, an important step on the way toward the party's goal of approving major tax reform legislation by the end of the year. While the budget resolution doesn't have the force of law, it allows Republicans to propose a tax bill that needs only 50 votes in the Senate, bypassing the threat of a Democratic filibuster that requires 60 votes for passage. Although all the details of the GOP tax reform proposal have not yet been announced, drafts of the bill specify tax cuts that cost $1.5 trillion over the next decade, where 80% of tax relief will benefit the top 1% wealthiest Americans. The plan calls for slashing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20% and repealing the inheritance tax on multi-million dollar estates. Under the proposal, the number of tax brackets would decrease from 7 to 3 or 4, the standard deduction would be doubled, and the child tax credit would be increased. While President Trump and Republicans say their goal is to boost the economy and provide middle-class tax relief, the elimination of local and state tax deductions and other changes to the tax code could actually increase taxes on millions of working families. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, senior fellow with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the winners and losers in the Republican tax reform plan and the real-world track record, which proves that trickle-down economics is a lie.
The plan we're looking at right now, as following a long tradition of Republican tax cut plans, is very specific on the details of which tax rates will be cut and which taxes will be repealed. The estate tax, gone. The corporate alternative minimum tax, which is designed to make sure that all corporations pay at least something, gone. The basic corporate income tax rate would be sharply reduced from 35% to 20%. On the personal income tax side, the top rate would go down from 39.6% to 35%. There would be a special new tax break for what's called pass-through businesses. These are often described as by their advocates as small businesses, but really are just generally very big businesses that happen to use a different set of rules for paying income tax. Instead of paying taxes as entities, they pass through the tax on their profits to the owners of the business who pay on the individual side. And the plan here is to drop the pass-through business tax rate to 25% instead of the 39.6% top rate that we currently have. So they're leading with sharp reductions in almost all the taxes that upper-income Americans pay on the individual side. The vague part is how they're going to pay for it. It's generally recognized that tax reform has two components in a deficit-challenged environment. One is what you're going to do to the rates, and the other is what you're going to do to the base, that is the stuff that's actually subject to the rates. The most straightforward diagnosis of what ought to be done is we need to close loopholes. You hear that language spoken by both sides all the time. On the corporate side in particular, we know that maybe half of all corporate profits are now being subjected to tax because of various loopholes. And so closing them seems like an important second component of this plan. Sadly, the outline we've been looking at most recently is pretty vague on many of the details of which loopholes would be closed. There's language about ending wasteful tax subsidies, but very little specific language on which ones would go away. On the individual side, there's a little more specificity. We know that the intention is to get rid of most itemized deductions while preserving only two, the charitable deduction and the mortgage interest deduction. Bad news is the very limited amount of loophole closing we're talking about is nowhere near enough by anyone's accounting to pay for the rate reductions. And the result is that we're looking at a multi-trillion dollar tax cut as it's currently configured over the next 10 years.
And Matthew, the rationale for Republicans for many decades now for cutting taxes for the wealthiest people in the United States is so-called trickle-down theory, where if you give tax breaks to the wealthiest folks, the theory goes you're going to create jobs and wealth and expansion that will benefit everybody in the middle and the bottom. But we have a record of these previous tax cuts, and it turns out from a lot of documentation and studies I've read that you can expand on here, trickle-down is a hoax.
The harsh reality is that while this story has been told for sometimes very eloquently for 30 years now, leading back to the President Reagan's tax cuts in 1981, there's never been a documented case in which it actually worked. The problem is that every time we've enacted tax cuts in the last 30 years that have been based on this premise, we've had to backpedal as a nation. We've had to undo them. Sometimes, as in the case of the Bush tax cuts of 2001, it's taken a decade of pitched battle for Congress to realize in a bipartisan way that, you know, they really had just dug the hole too deep. In other cases, as was true in 1981, although people don't seem to want to remember it too much, it took about a year for Congress to realize that they'd overstepped their bounds and to start undoing the Reagan tax cuts. But in every case, whether it's these examples at the national level or more recently the Kansas tax cuts, which, you know, a lot of people have talked about in the last few years, they end up not working. These tax cuts end up primarily costing a lot of money, bestowing huge tax benefits on the owners of businesses and their shareholders, on the best off Americans, and providing little or nothing in terms of demonstrable job growth, income growth, or even direct tax cuts for the rest of us.
That was Matthew Gardner, senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Find links to more analysis on the proposed Trump-Republican tax plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hurricane Maria's destructive winds denuded much of the island of Puerto Rico's trees and lush tropical forests. While the trees will grow back, the current situation has triggered floods, landslides, loss of fertile topsoil, increased temperatures, and other problems. The loss of trees and vegetation have been concerns in Haiti for decades, both from natural disasters fueled by climate change and from Haitians chopping down trees to make charcoal for fuel. Because the entire nation is almost treeless, from the air it's easy to see the boundary between Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the island of Hispaniola, which they share, where protected trees on the Dominican side stand in stark contrast to Haiti's barren landscape. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Haitian-American Yannick Joseph, the New Haven, Connecticut-based director of the Haiti Renaissance Institute. The institute is a project of Green Cities, Green Villages, which is a sustainable development and renewable energy incubator founded by Joseph in 2001. Since 2010, she's worked with grassroots groups in Haiti, including the Association of Peasants of Fondwa and local development committees, to advocate the establishment of a Haitian National Forestry Corps.
A National Forestry Corps in Haiti is desperately needed because, as you know, deforestation is massive in Haiti. Whenever there are floods, there are landslides, a lot of people die. And a National Forestry Corps would help with flood management and would also help to keep people from uprooting trees before they reach maturity. It takes about 10 years for a tree to reach maturity. That's a very long time in a country where people are impoverished. Also, a National Forestry Corps would also help to reforest marginal areas, areas that are hard to reach, like in mountains in Haiti. A National Forestry Corps would also create permanent jobs in forestry and flood management for Haitians. People may have heard that very recently the Haitian army was reconstituted. We at the Haitian Renaissance Institute think it was a very big mistake. Haiti does not need a Haitian army. What we need is a National Forestry Corps, and it can be financed by the Haitian government, by the World Bank, and other international institutions. We also believe that with the support of the American people and with institutions like Yale, a National Forestry Corps is a very doable achievement. The Dominican Republic has had a National Forestry Corps for more than 50 years, and it's about time that Haiti had one.
Besides your organization, is anybody else pushing for this? Are you working with other groups in Haiti?
Well, ironically, there has been talk for the creation of a National Forestry Corps on and off for the last 20 years. Even the former president, Michel Martelly, the entertainer, he spoke of a National Forestry Corps when he first came to power. But nothing has been done about forming a National Forestry Corps. And we, meaning the Haitian Renaissance Institute and the Peasants Association of Fondwa, we were very disappointed and very dismayed to find out that instead of the formation of a National Forestry Corps, a Haitian army, which we do not need, has been reconstituted. And I just want to say also that according to many climate change experts, right now, the most readily available alternative for developing countries to address carbon emissions is tropical reforestation, and there's funding for it.
So this would be something that you think is likely to come to pass in the next few years, would you say?
Yes, it is likely to come to pass, but we will need the support of the American people. We will need the support of New Haven and of Yale and other institutions of higher learning. We'll be working in Haiti to make it happen.
Are you aware of any projects, even like small projects locally in Haiti, to do any reforestation?
Yes, there are many reforestation projects in Haiti, but they are scattershot and they are not comprehensive. In order for us to have effective reforestation in Haiti, we need a number of factors. One of them is cooking fuel alternatives. This is why the University of Fondwa and the Haitian Renaissance Initiative, we have partnered also to introduce a number of renewable energy alternatives in Haiti. One of them is the anaerobic biodigester technology, which would provide cooking fuel through biogas to Haitian households. which would be a way to prevent people from cutting down trees to make charcoal. There are also other alternatives, which consist of people and groups making charcoal out of the compressed waste paper and waste biomass, which is plant waste. They convert it into charcoal briquettes, and people are now buying these reconstituted charcoal briquettes as fuel alternatives.
That was Yannick Joseph of the Haiti Renaissance Institute. Learn more about the deforestation in Haiti and the proposal to establish a national forestry corps by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WTND in Macon, Illinois, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Puerto Rico, a colony by any name. On Christopher Columbus's second voyage to what was called the West Indies, he visited Puerto Rico, called Borinquen by the Arawak natives of the island. Columbus docked in November 1493. And with him came the force and greed of the Spanish Empire. For four centuries, Spain brought imperial exploitation, slavery, repression, and death to the Arawaks, and in its place arose a new people, the mixture of Southern Europe, Spain, the remnants of Indians and Africans. After the U.S. pushed a weakened Spain out of Cuba, it seized Puerto Rico as well. From that seizure of 1898 by the U.S. until today, Puerto Rico has been an American property under the U.S. government's thumb. Did you know that Puerto Ricans can't vote for president? That they on the island can't vote in general elections? They fight in every American war and die in every conflict. When U.S. businesses open up shop in PR, they are exempt from taxes, money that could aid the island in its health and educational needs. And just days ago, after being lashed by nature's fury as Hurricane Maria, when they dared complain about slow American response, the moronic U.S. president called Puerto Ricans ingrates. Ingrates. Now, weeks later, they are still suffering. No water, no food, no power. They are Americans in name, but in fact, they are colonial subjects of the U.S. Empire, used by America, and then forgotten. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan, a Prison Radio.
Charles Kareem Diggs. I'm calling from Granite Fort Prison in Pennsylvania. The title of my little speech is, Are We Willing to Imagine? Try to imagine a prison system that uses its resources to cure, heal, and build human values and character. Every state and federal prison system has one common denominator, and that is security. They also have programs, school, trade, and organizational activities. Nothing trumps security. Most prisons conduct body counts 3 and 4 times each day. They also count numerous times while you are asleep. There is not much rehabilitation under that design. Meals take up the rest of your time. And we imagine a prison system reflecting modern technology, neuroscience, and returning human beings back to society with more values and a sense of belonging. American prison system is a failure. First, the priority is everything is about security. Prisons are counted and counted and counted. The visitors are counted. This fear is ingrained in the entire system. Secondly, the type of stress associated with counting bodies expresses a level of fear and anxiety. There is no imagination for change. A healthy design for prisons is lost in the very construction of the prison. With two prisoners in a small cell and limiting number of toilet flushes every 15 minutes is a waste of talent. To save water and to maximize space seems to be the reasons to spend between $200 and $400 million to build one prison. The governors and prison commissioners need courage to imagine a prison system built to develop the moral and social skills needed to function in society. Criminologists and prison experts need to take on a new imagination that represents a wholesome strategy that will return missing women and men back to society, a balanced person. After the prisons are built, it takes another $50 to $70 million to operate with staff. The banks provide the bonds and the taxpayers pay it off. Whatever city or county that a person is sentenced from, that is the county that pays the state to house you. It has become a business model for containing citizens for long periods of time. In this 21st century, with the advancement in science and the human brain, I believe we could design a prison system that helps the prisoner develop a positive, law-abiding place in society. With 3 million people in prison, suffocating in prison, we may want to take another look and try imagining a system that will create the type of person who will return to society, a secure mental person. This imagination requires that we remove the obsession with security as a tool for managing human beings. Human beings living inside of buildings don't need more layers of domination over them. And finally, the beginning of healing, it comes from our imagination that these people in prison have somehow become flawed in their moral values. Intelligent prison managers and governors have the resources to change the dehumanizing systems. We don't need more money. We need human beings to imagine a different world inside of prisons. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're going to have a pretty damn good show today, all right? First, you're going to be hearing a piece, a trailer for a new speech, a new film, actually, an hour-long film that's available at revcom.us, and it's really, you can see the whole thing, but today you're going to see a trailer, and it's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The title of the talk in the film is The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. But let me first tell you about the rest of the show. The novelist William Faulkner wrote, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And we're living in a time when there are many lessons and analogies and warnings that people are deriving from history. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear an interview I did with historian and author James Loewen about the Civil War, a war begun over slavery. James Loewen traces how this fact, which is easy to discover, has been covered up and distorted to the point that even teachers of history are part of trying to confuse people about the blatant white supremacy behind all of the Confederate flags and monuments and behind all the talk of our heritage. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about the Hollywood blacklist, McCarthyism, and the intensely repressive political atmosphere it created in the 1950s. There's going to be a special program marking the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the blacklist in Los Angeles, and we're going to be talking to our first guest about it.
And our guest is going to be Ed Rampell, a film historian, author, and critic, and a writer for Hollywood Progressive. He's the organizer of the 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood blacklist. And it's going to be a really, really interesting event, and we'll talk with Ed about that in about 10 minutes or so. All right, so let's go to the trailer for the film of the speech by Bob Avakian, and it's a mind blower, so check this out.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people, acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination, to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program? Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system. Whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer for a new talk by Bob Avakian. And the trailer, you can find it at revcom.us, or the whole film you can find at revcom.us, all right? And it's really it's a must-see. It's a must-see. And the film is The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. A talk by Bob Avakian. And once again, that's revcom, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M dot us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, dot U-S, okay? Go there and you'll see the hookup for this talk. And don't miss it, sisters and brothers. It's going to bend your mind. It's going to open your head. It's going to be a whole lot of new knowing, all right? That's what it's going to be. That's right. That's how I'm talking today, right? And I think it's really going to be extremely important in terms of what lies ahead of us, what the future is going to be. And the big step to the kind of future that humanity needs begins on November 4th. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go, stay in the streets day and night, until the Trump-Pence regime is driven out. So I'm going to play another short clip before we talk with Ed Rampell, partly because I really think it's great. It's something that was inspired by Eminem, and it's done by a whole lot of different people in New York. And you can see the video on the Refuse Fascism Twitter feed, which is at Refuse Fascism.
It's the calm before the storm, right? How was I gonna start this? I forgot.
That's an awfully hot coffee pot.
Should I drop it on Donald Trump?
Probably not.
But more than that, I've got a plot.
Take to the streets November 4th and do not stop.
For the people of the world, not just our block.
Because what we got in office now is a kamikaze that can probably cause a nuclear holocaust.
And while he waits for to quiet down, he'll gas his plane up
and fly around until the bombing stops.
Density's heightened. Tensions are rising. Trump, when it comes to giving a shit, you're as stingy as I am.
Racism's the only thing that he's fantastic for.
Because that's how he gets his f***ing rocks off.
And he's orange.
Yeah, sick tan.
Yeah, sick tan.
All these tragedies, and this man is bored and would rather get into a Twitter storm with the Packers. Who's gonna pay for his extravagant trips back and forth with his fam?
From golf courts to mansions.
From his endorsement of Bannon, support for the Klansmen.
Tiki torches in hand for the soldier that's black and comes home from Iraq.
Is told to go back to Africa.
Fork and dagger for this 94-year-old racist grandpa who keeps ignoring our historical deplorable factors.
Now, if you're a black athlete, you're a spoiled little brat whore trying to use your platform or stature to give a voice to those who don't have one.
That. This is for Colin. Ball up a fist and keep that shit bald like Donald the Pig.
He's gonna get rid of all immigrants. He's gonna build that thing up taller than this.
If he does build it, I hope it's rock solid with bricks.
Because like him in politics, I'm using all of his strengths.
Drawing a line in the sand. You're either for or against.
If you can decide who you like more and you split, I'll do it for you with this.
You, the rest of America, stand up.
We love humanity and we love this planet, but we hate Trump.
We love humanity and we love the planet,
but we hate Trump and Pence.
All right, that was a piece from refusefascism.org. And so please go to the website for the sake of humanity and the planet. And that website is refusefascism.org. And right now, along the same theme, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Ed Rampell. Now, as I said earlier, Ed Rampell is a guy who's been wandering the streets of Hollywood for a long time, okay? And he can speak for himself on that. He's a film historian. He's an author, critic, and writer for Hollywood Progressive. He's the organizer of the 70th anniversary of the commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist. It's called An American, a Reenactment of the HUAC Hearings, and it's happening at the Writers Guild Foundation. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. And those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And our event is going to be reminding America about what happened exactly 70 years ago that day on October 27th, 1947, when the very first member of the Hollywood 10, screenwriter John Howard Lawson, was called to testify by the fascistic House Un-American Activities Committee, and they gaveled him down and they threw him off the witness stand.
Well, give people, because this is something that actually helped to shape like an entire ethos, an entire, it dropped a cloud over the entire, creative industry. It dropped a cloud. It was part of actually spreading a fascist, rule over the rest of the country, going into that kind of stuff, bringing out the thing. If you spoke up, if you said one word, or you were even accused by an angry neighbor of speaking a word in favor or something in favor of, whether it was the Soviet Union or whether it was, what was going on in China, or whether it was just talking about what was happening here and talking about that there seemed to be something wrong with a place that you couldn't actually have these actors and creative people actually stand up and say something about the conditions people are living in and what they need to do about it. Tell us a little bit more about actually what did happen, because as I read what you're bringing here, you're bringing the voices of a lot of, who no longer are around, the voices of people who are no longer around, but whose story really does have to be heard in order for people to understand the depth of the fascistic terrorism that we're living under now and how it's only going to get worse unless this regime is not driven out.
And in terms of spreading the cloud, we should never forget that two of our worst presidents, Nixon and Reagan, grew out of the House Un-American Activities Committee. They used anti-communism to develop their careers, and we are going to have a combination of blacklist survivors, including 100-year-old Marsha Hunt. She just turned 100 this week, and Norma Barsman, the blacklisted screenwriter, now 97, are joining the children, the grandchildren, the nieces, the nephews of the blacklisted, persecuted artists, plus a number of today's progressive Hollywood talents, such as Richard Dreyfuss, the Oscar winner, Rosario Dawson, James Cromwell, who, by the way, Jamie's father, John Cromwell, was blacklisted. Andrea Markovici, who played Woody Allen's girlfriend in The Hunt. Ileana Douglas. Now, that name Douglas, very interesting because her grandfather was Melvin Douglas and her grandmother was Helen Cahagan Douglas, who was the congresswoman who ran against Nixon, who parlayed HUAC into a run for the U.S. Senate, and he called Ileana Douglas's grandmother the Pink Lady and said she was pink down to her underwear. And another Douglas, unrelated, the granddaughter of Kelsey Douglas, is going to read a statement personally written by Kirk Douglas for our historic remembrance about how Kirk helped to break the blacklist when he gave screen credit to the blacklisted screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, as did Otto Preminger in Exodus in 1960. We're also going to be joined by film director Jeremy Kagan, who did the greatest movie ever made about the new left in America called Catherine, based on the Weather Underground. And his new movie out is called Shot, about gun violence in America. K.B. Solomon is going to be portraying the great Paul Robeson. And in what our readers are going to be doing at the Writers Guild is reading portions of the transcripts of the testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee that began in 1947, plus some personal remembrances and plus some other blacklist-related texts such as Red Channels.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Ed Rampell. Ed is a film historian, author, critic, and he's a writer for The Hollywood Progressive. And we're talking about the 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood blacklist, Un-American, a reenactment of the HUAC hearings. Tell me this, Ed, because one of the things we have a limited amount of time, and I think it's really impressive, all the people you have coming to speak to this. But there's also a point here about people understanding what it meant, because we're living under a fascist regime right now. There's, what I think is really true is that, in fact, you're looking at Trump and you're looking at the Trump-Pence regime, and this is a fascist regime. There's not a question about that. The question is how quickly are they going to get it fully consolidated, and how are they going to roll it out? And I want people to understand, one, what did it mean both for these? Look, it was an era where people who dared to say anything at all, especially in the arts because of the influence of the arts, basically people were smashed. They were hit very, very hard. It meant that, people committed suicide. It meant people could not work ever again. There were people that were, just left out there to, going to prison, all of these various things. And at the same time, it had a meaning for people and the type of society that was allowed to, to flourish after they had this kind of thing. And I'd like to talk about those two things. We have a few minutes in that. I know you have a big thing you want to let loose on to let us hear. As soon as we're done talking about this, then we're going to go into your big surprise.
Well, it was not only that you had to talk about what you did, but you also had to inform on everybody you knew. You had to be a snitch. You had to crawl like a rat in order to be allowed to continue working in the entertainment industry. And this set up a climate of paranoia, of conformity and fear in America, beginning with 1947, the HUAC hearings, and then going into the McCarthy era that started around 1950 or so. So this was an all-pervasive culture of paranoia. The Communist Party was a fully legal political organization in the United States, and yet you not only had to be associated with it, but refuse to name the names of people who went to meetings with you in the 1930s against fascism in Spain, or who went on a picket line with you, or helped build the Screenwriters Guild, and so on and so forth. So it was a very repressive culture, and we must never forget that Senator Joe McCarthy, who was in the Senate, HUAC was in the House, McCarthy had a separate committee in the Senate. We must never, ever forget who his attorney was. His chief counsel was Roy Cohn, who became Donald Trump's attorney and mentor. So we see this. You talked about a continuity at the top of your show from the Confederacy to fascism, with white supremacy being an important part of that component, of course. Now we could see the continuity from HUAC in the McCarthy era to the Trump regime with the full frontal attacks on the First Amendment that are going on today. And we saw what happened during the 1950s. Up to 300 people in Hollywood, actors, directors, screenwriters, producers, and others, were not allowed to work, not only because they wouldn't recant and inform on themselves, but because they refused to be rats and to snitch and inform on others. And this was a climate of fear across the country. But what we are stressing in our program is the resistance, the defiance of so many people who confronted HUAC, who confronted McCarthyism, and were eventually triumphant.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, so I want to move in because we're running out of time. I want to move into your big...
And also people went to jail and were fined because they would not cooperate as friendly witnesses with the committee, by the way. I should add that.
And many people were forced to leave the country. There were writers collectives and filmmakers collectives that developed in places like England and places like, you know, other countries in Europe and around the world where people were actually forced to go to try and continue to produce their art, but also to stay alive. And, you know, you think about this. This was that fascist tendency that was there in the Congress and the rest of the stuff. And now you think about what we're doing today and what's happening today in terms of you actually have a fascist regime in power and it's moving very quickly to consolidate things. And
we must stop it.
What's that?
We must stop them.
Absolutely, Ed. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. That's a really very important. So Lau, tell us you had a special announcement you wanted to make. You said that there was a big scoop I was going to get on my show. So let's go with it, brother.
For the first time ever in the United States, we will have a clip from the new French documentary called Red in Blue, which is a film about how Hollywood depicted the Russian Revolution, which turns 100 on November 7th. But the big scoop I have for you today is that I personally contacted the office of attorney Mark Geragos to invite the number one blacklisted talent today in America to participate in our historic remembrance of the witch hunt in Hollywood. And I'm talking about Mark Geragos' client, Colin Kaepernick. Colin, if you are listening, if you get word of this, join us. Come and take a knee, read some of the HUAC testimony, and let's remind everybody that the blacklisting, that talents like Colin Kaepernick today is what happened in America 70 years ago, and we're going to stop it. We're going to remind everybody. We're going to stop it and nip it in the bud before it gets worse.
All right, Ed, we're going to have to wrap this up now, but I want to let people know again, it's Un-American, a reenactment of the HUAC hearings, 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist. All right, Ed, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Keep the faith.
All right, man, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ed Rampell, and he's been talking with us about the anniversary, the 70th anniversary of the commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist, and that was which was part of fascistic tendencies in the country, in the Senate, in the Congress, and in other places that actually went after people who dared to speak up against what was going on in terms of against imperialism, against even quite frankly even against the mildest liberal opposition. People who opened their mouths were squashed. They were forced out of. They were not able to work. Some of them never able to work again. You know, the works that they had produced were stopped, and it was an era that. You know what? It was an era that everybody needs to learn about and understand. And as Ed was saying, you know, understand it. And there's an understand. And I would add that there's a reason to understand it because we're faced with something that's even more, okay? We're not talking about fascistic tendencies. We're not talking about people who may do this or may do that. We're not talking about people who will just solely put their eyes on what can they do in the realm of culture, although that is an important realm. We're not talking about people who are satisfied with making a few laws here and there. We are talking about, and we're not talking about people who might come into power. We are talking right now about a regime that is in power, that is a fascist regime, okay? That's what we're talking about. And if we sit here, and pretend that we don't know that, if we sit here and pretend that there's not much that we can do, that we can wait until the, oh, I don't know, you know, the elections that come up in the next year or so, we can do something there. We can wait until the presidential elections. We'll be able to rope them in and control them. These are people who are hell-bent on consolidating as quickly as possible their fascist rule. And when you think about what that means, we've been having, you know, on this show, we've had tons and tons of people come in, people who are experts on what the Nazis did in Germany. And you think about today, how much more there is in terms of what the fascists can and will do. And they have promised to impose fascist forms of rule. They haven't said we're thinking about this or, you know, if you don't watch it, we're going to do this. They have actually promised to impose fascist forms of rule, and they are keeping their promises every damn day, day after day. You can't open the newspaper without looking, without seeing something new, some new element of this. And they're putting the bars all in place. And so that what they want is then the time comes, and some of them will go quicker. They'll make a big move and they'll go quicker. And what is it going to mean for the people here? What is it going to mean for the people who always suffer like the hardest here? What is it going to mean for oppressed nationalities? What's it going to mean for women? What's it going to mean for all people? And what's it going to mean for the rest of the world? Think about this. They're talking about pillaging the world. They're already talking about the wars that they need to have. All the threats they've been making against North Korea. All of these things are related to the kind of regime we have, sisters and brothers. So we've got to learn from the past in order to analyze what's going on in the present. That's why I think the new talk, the new film of the talk by Bob Avakian, is so important. In fact, let's do another short clip from that, okay? This is a one-minute clip about what we're facing.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries. With the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's a piece taken from his new talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be running an interview I did a number of years ago with Jim Lowen, the co-editor of the book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight, beat 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Beat 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homey queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Beat 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look.
Welcome back. That was Beat 'em In by Oscar Brown, the late, great Oscar Brown Jr. At a time when people are debating and struggling over what the Confederate flag and other symbols of slavery and white supremacy are all about, I thought that the following interview would shine a light of reality on Southern heritage and Southern pride and that great culture they all want to uphold. I spoke with James Lowen, co-editor of the Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. This book uses the words and documents of the Confederates and Neo-Confederates themselves to show that the Confederate leaders were honest and out front about why they started the Civil War. It was to protect slavery and a society based on white supremacy and slavery and the perpetual subjugation of black people. That's the heritage and tradition represented by the Confederate flag and all those statues and monuments to Confederate generals. So without any further ado, here's an interview I did a number of years back with James Lowen. I really am pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, James Lowen. Now, Jim's been a guest on the show a number of times before, and he's just come out with a new book, a book that he co-edited with Edward H. Sebesta. And the name of that book is The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. It's an incredibly, I mean, really a fascinating book. And again, once again, he's kind of opened my eyes up with, basically his ruthlessly honest and searching approach to history and really trying to make sure that people are talking about history accurately. Jim's the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. He's also the author of Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and a few other books, all of which number among my favorite books. Jim, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, well, let's jump into this. As I said, this book was really kind of an eye-opener for me on many different levels. One, just the stuff that I learned, but also the kind of situation that you describe in the book. And I want you to tell people what the book is about and what compelled you to pull it together.
Sure. Well, I had another aha experience just last Friday. Now, of course, the book came out in August, and I wrote it before then. But this is the kind of thing that keeps happening. Last Friday, I was keynoting the American Association for State and Local History, which was meeting in Oklahoma City. Now, these are the folks who run history museums and historic houses and forts and stuff like that all across the U.S. So in the middle of my talk, I asked them, why did the South secede? Why did 11 states, beginning with South Carolina, leave the Federal Union? Well, there's always four answers you get, and they are: the South seceded over slavery, the South seceded because of four, states' rights. The South seceded because of the election of Lincoln, and the South seceded over tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. So I said, okay, let's vote. And my one-liner is, unlike Chicago, you can only vote once. All right, everybody laughed, and then we proceeded to vote. And what happened was another one of these, we might call them an aha experience for me, only they've really become an oh-no experience. This time, more than 80% of the group voted states' rights. Now, states' rights always wins. When I do it with groups of teachers, it gets 60 to 75% of the vote. But here with historic site managers, it got at least 80%. Now, as you can already infer, that's not the right answer. can I read from one of these documents?
Sure, definitely.
These folks just haven't ever read the documents, and the documents are never included, not even a phrase from them, is included in American history textbooks that you have in high school. So the very first state to leave the Union was, of course, South Carolina, and they left it on Christmas Eve, 150 years ago this Christmas. And here's why. They say why. Quote, "We assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof." Now, that sounds vague, constitutional obligations, but they go right on to tell us what they're talking about. They go on, "The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due." Well, that is, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause. Uh-huh. And so it's beginning to look like slavery might be the right answer. And then they go on to talk about states' rights. And amazingly enough, they are against states' rights. And they tell us exactly which states and which rights upset them. And, for instance, they say, the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and they name all the states going out to Iowa. All these states have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. And they go right back to the fugitive slave problem, and then they talk about, for example, the state of New York. Now, New York no longer allows what's called slavery transit. So this was a kind of idea, for instance, that a, let's suppose you're a rich family in Charleston, and you don't want to spend August in Charleston. You want to spend it maybe watching Broadway plays. But you don't want to do your own cooking, so you want to bring your cook along. Well, New York says, uh-uh, we're trying to be a free state. If you bring a slave into New York, she becomes free. Well, South Carolina's outraged at this. They're outraged as well with New England, because the New England states let blacks vote. Well, who votes in America was a state's right until the 15th Amendment gets passed, two whole eras after this. But nevertheless, South Carolina takes it upon themselves to say, this is another reason we're seceding. These people are letting blacks vote. It's an outrage. So in other words, it's all about slavery and about the connecting thing with slavery, namely white supremacy. And it has nothing at all to do with states' rights, except that the southern states are against states' rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point you make. And, you know, one of the things that you talk about, too, and you just sort of briefly mentioned this, but that this is, you know, there's all these other forces in society. You talk about historic site managers, but you also mention in your book even things like the National Archives website and yep. and teachers who really have they're teaching things that are completely untrue about what was behind the Civil War.
Yep.
And, you know, and then textbooks. And that really kind of sits in your stomach and then just makes you
Let me mention even a worse one, because it's so blatant. Many folks in California have become naturalized citizens, right? They came mm-hmm. in from Mexico or Vietnam or wherever they came in from as non-citizens. And then in order to become a citizen, you have to pass a history test, among other things. Mm-hmm. This is 100 multiple choice questions. Each of them has one right answer, except for one question. The question, why did the southern states secede? And that one, they allow two right answers. Either the right answer, slavery, or if you say the wrong answer, states' rights, they count that right too. So it's the only question on this federal test that has two right answers. And that right there shows the power of what we call the neo-Confederates even today.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. I wanted to pursue this thing about the textbooks a little bit because,
sure.
you know, and it's related to what you just said. You know, in the book, you sort of cite a certain amount of relativism in the presentation of what was the cause of the Civil War. Like you're saying right now with these two possible correct answers.
Yeah.
You know, and they come out and there's a thing where people are saying even you can't know for sure what was really the cause of the Civil War.
And you can too.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, I agree with you. And you present a few reasons why this happens, because it's very, you know, it should give people pause to think that the textbooks are being written from a standpoint of you can't know for sure. And like you said, you can too. Why do you think the textbooks are written like this?
They don't want to offend anybody. And, you know, it's interesting. Like when I speak all over the country. And when I speak in Columbia, South Carolina, for instance, I usually speak about what we get wrong about the Civil War and secession. You know, I have a talk, for instance, about what we get wrong about the American Indians and about the Pilgrims, but I save that for Massachusetts because I don't want to pull any punch, you know. And people come, and they listen, and even people like the Sons of Confederate Veterans, they come, they then ask questions. I don't think I've convinced them all, but they at least listen. But the textbook publishers are too timid to do that. And so they imagine that they might lose an adoption. And all of the southern states adopt statewide. Most infamously, of course, Texas adopts statewide. It's a more or less southern state. And the publishers certainly don't want to offend Texas. And saying just flatly that the South seceded for slavery might offend somebody. So let's not say that. And they'll say, well, historians debate why the Confederacy left the Union. Some say slavery, some states' rights, issues about tariffs, the election of Lincoln. They'll say all four of those in one paragraph. And they will never quote a document to support their position. And I think the key reason is because all of the documents support only one position, and that's slavery. Well, they do mention the election of Lincoln. That's for sure. But they're upset with the election of Lincoln because Lincoln represents a new party which is against slavery. So it all comes back to the S word in the end.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned in this, in the book, is you give about four reasons, and I really wanted to try and zero in on at least a couple of them, because one of them is you say, or maybe just this one, but you say that there's actually this point of not wanting to offend anybody, as you've just been talking about. And, yep. You know, I just spoke with Peter Ward, who he's an environmental writer. He writes on climate change and melting of the ice caps, and he's also a paleontologist. And he was talking about the terrible time he has in trying to get what he's discovered or uncovered about the truth about global warming and the rest of this and climate change, and trying to get it out there, he gets a lot of flack. And he said that actually he's found that there's a tremendous amount of scientific reticence among scientists who are basically censoring themselves because they don't want to step out of the flock. They don't want to put themselves out there, not just because of the crude reason of I won't get, you know, research money, but also because they don't want to take the chance of being out there as the point man for something that is going to attract a lot of flack in society in general. Do you think that's also true in relation to these textbooks and how they're being written? And the fact that teachers even won't go to the sources that you have proven through this really impressive collection of Confederate and neo-Confederate documents that actually show the truth. Do you think that kind of reticence is also operational here?
Sure. I'd still just call it under the general heading of timidity. But yeah, they don't want to be the one textbook that gets off of Tennessee, for instance, adopts every competent book just about in American history. And actually, Tennessee would not knock a book out for this reason, I don't think. But publishers imagine they might, you know, so let's not say it.
Yeah. And see, and that's the problem is when you're dealing with the question of seeking the truth, it's a big problem, because if you're going to then present to others, and especially in, you know, involving textbooks and teachers, you would think that the purpose is to bring the truth to people in the classrooms. And
yeah, especially because the darn books are so huge. You know, the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me came out about 3 years ago, and it'll be the last edition, I can assure everyone. I'm not going to read any more of these textbooks. They're such a near-death experience. For that edition, I read six more of these books, and they've actually gotten longer. They now average 1,152 pages. And yet, with all those pages, they don't quote any documents, or almost no documents. For example, one of them actually has two whole paragraphs about Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech. These two leaden paragraphs written by whoever writes these textbooks, it isn't usually the names that are on them, only use three words from Bryan, and those are cross of gold. Now, William Jennings Bryan is a powerful writer, you know. He writes something like, thou shalt not press down upon labor's brow this crown of thorns. Thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. Any 11th grader, any 6th grader could understand that better than they can understand the words of the textbook writers. But they don't quote them. And so they have this tradition of not quoting. They could just hide behind the documents. I think that'd be just fine. You know, let South Carolina tell you why it seceded. South Carolina is quite upfront about it.
Well, let's dig into this, because actually the point that you make in the book and what you show through all these documents is exactly what you're saying. They're upfront about this. There's the question of the Confederacy was really about, the Civil War was really about the preservation of slavery as an economic system, and then all the ideological trappings that go along with that, racism and white supremacy and so on. And, you know, the part of the problem or part of the thing that comes up here is, so you've mentioned in your most recent book what really happened. You get into the question of historiography, and I'm
yes.
curious as to how that applies to this situation.
Oh, it does indeed. That's a good question. And the reason our book is titled The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader is because we don't just have documents from the Confederacy period itself. After the Civil War ends, of course, we have Reconstruction. And now the same people, in this case, they're still Confederates. We might call them ex-Confederates because you can't be a Confederate anymore. But they still want to maintain their point of view. They can't maintain slavery because that was ended by the 13th Amendment. But they certainly can maintain white supremacy, which is, of course, the handmaiden of slavery. And so they do. I mean, at the end of Reconstruction, they reimpose white supremacy. And then in 1890, beginning with Mississippi, all of the southern states proceed to keep blacks from voting, quote, legally, unquote. I mean, it's really illegal because it's all a violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments. But the U.S. doesn't do anything about it, and so they actually do it, quote, legally. Well, this sets in motion what we call the Nadir. Some people pronounce it Nadir, N-A-D-I-R. We're not talking Ralph. The Nadir of race relations. And this is the period 1890 to 1940 when the U.S. goes more racist in its ideology and its thinking than at any other point in our history. And it's during this time then that the neo-Confederates, and we have to call them neo-Confederates now because most of the Confederates are dead. We're talking 1890 to 1940. It's a new generation. But they still maintain elements of the Confederate line. They certainly maintain the emphasis on white supremacy. And now they actually rename the Civil War, and they no longer call it the Civil War. Now is when it gets called the War Between the States. And now, 1890 to 1940, is when they start making the claim that secession was for states' rights. And so if you just page through our book, you can see the reasons for secession changing as you go through the years and as you go through the pages.
I was going to ask you about that in terms of the through line between the Confederates and the neo-Confederates. It's, you know, this point about maintaining this notion of white supremacy and the inferiority of black people to white people. It's not that they're still fighting the Civil War in one sense, but in another sense, they are still fighting. And it's not so much to reinstitute slavery, but it does this question of actually maintaining the domination of black people, the subordinate position of black people and the domination of them by white people in relation to the whole political and economic setup certainly seems to be serviced by this continuation of that understanding of the Civil War.
And you know, one thing a lot of people don't realize, a lot of younger people don't have any idea that the Republicans weren't always the party of white supremacy as they now are. In the 19th century, the Democrats were the party of white supremacy. And they said so, and they called themselves the White Man's Party well into the 1920s. But in 1964, the two parties completed a flip-flop on this matter. And as one of the actual documents in our book, we show two maps of votes for president for Abraham Lincoln in 1860 and then for John Kerry in 2004. And by gosh, the same states that Abraham Lincoln carried, John Kerry carried, with only three exceptions. Lincoln carried Iowa, Ohio, and Indiana, and Kerry didn't manage to carry them. But the map looks almost identical. So the people, it's a flip-flop then, of the people who supported Kerry were, in their antecedent generations, the people who supported Lincoln.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. Now, let's talk about the relevance of all this for today. You know, I have to tell you, when my son was growing up, I was living in Washington, D.C., and one of the things that happened, here we were living in a majority black city, and yes, the neighborhood we were in, it was majority black and immigrant, and my son was really deep into watching The Dukes of Hazzard.
Yes.
And he wasn't the only one in the neighborhood, and he wasn't the only nationality, you know, in the neighborhood, yeah, in terms of, you know, watching it. It was actually all the kids, they all went out and they got big wheels, they used to call them, the king.
And I think what we have to do is we have to tell your readers that the Dukes of Hazzard drove around in this red car that had a Confederate flag painted on its roof.
That's exactly where I was
going. I knew that's where you're
going. Right, exactly. And my son got a big wheels that came complete with Confederate flags to stick all over the place, patches, all this stuff. He was so irate when I told him he was not going to put that on there. But it just struck me in thinking about this, because at that time there was that thing going on. And then I remember at the same time there was the struggle to have Martin Luther King's birthday declared a holiday. And at one point, Virginia opted,
yes,
to, they said, okay, we'll do it, but we're going to do it on the same day as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson Day.
Yep.
You know, and to me, you know, it really fits in a lot with what you're actually pointing out in this book.
Yep. At this point, the neo-Confederates have, in terms of any explicitness, they've kind of given up on white supremacy. And so the most recent document we include in the book, actually, is Republican Governor Sonny Perdue of Georgia, his proclamation of Confederate History Month 2 years ago. And, of course, like all proclamations, it's got all these whereases. But it's very interesting. The number one whereas in there is this one. Whereas, among those who served the Confederacy were many African Americans, both free and slave, who saw action in the Confederate armed forces in many combat roles. Well, that's not true. That's flatly not true. It's less true than the idea that there's a whole bunch of Jewish officers in Hitler's army, which actually was true. There were no blacks in combat roles in the Confederate army who were known to be black until 3 weeks before the end of the war. And the reason there weren't is because the Confederate policy wouldn't allow it. And so we include these documents that we don't allow no blacks. And then we furthermore include the document 3 weeks before Richmond gets liberated, where they changed their minds. And so why, the question comes up, why would Sonny Perdue write something that's so completely false? And I think the answer is, the reasoning goes like this. Look, you people, we're going to celebrate Confederate Heritage Month, and we all should celebrate it because it couldn't have been about slavery. It couldn't have been about white supremacy because, look, all these black folks fought on our side. See? is a non sequitur, but besides that, it didn't happen.
But let me ask you this, the point about white supremacy. I know what you're saying in terms of they sort of similarly to how the neo-Confederates had to back off of actually doing the thing around, well, we were about slavery and we did think slavery was important and all this, and they couldn't really make that the central argument point. But they could then get into white supremacy. And, you know, you saw it in a lot of different ways where they were talking about they were so upset. All the way up into the 1970s, they were still arguing about the natural stupidity of black people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's developed over the course of time. But it seems to me it's a little hard, I think, to say that they have given up on the promotion of white supremacy because you look at
this. Oh, I still think that's their goal. It's certainly the goal of the Council of Concerned Citizens, for instance,
exactly,
which is one of the primary neo-Confederate organizations around right now. And people who are in the sense of Confederate veterans fall into two groups, I think, the white supremacists and people who lost family members generations ago, admittedly, but still, in the Confederate Army, and they want to mainly honor them. And I appreciate that that's a different frame of mind. But there's something dangerous about the whole states' rights claim. And what's dangerous about it is that it has converted the Confederacy into kind of a David against Goliath romantic figure with whom we wish to identify. And this has several payoffs to today. Let me just mention a couple of them. I was just in Oklahoma City at this meeting. And, of course, Oklahoma City, about 10 years ago, was the site of this horrific bombing of the federal building, the Murrah office building. The number one guy who did it, Timothy McVeigh, he was arrested for his mugshot wearing a T-shirt. And it was a neo-Confederate T-shirt. And the T-shirt says, it has a picture of Abraham Lincoln in the front, and it says, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always with tyrants," which is, of course, what John Wilkes Booth yelled on the stage of Ford's Theater right after he killed him. And so McVeigh is identifying with Booth. McVeigh is saying, we should kill the president. We should kill our leaders. Well, you're hearing that from some of the far-out members of the Tea Party folks. This woman in Nevada says, you know, bring your guns to Washington, and so on. And there is talk about secession by candidates for governor in Georgia, by the governor of Texas, by Mr. Sarah Palin, if you will, when he was a member of the Alaska First Party. That's a secessionist party in Alaska. And it's not necessarily totally harmless. I mean, the folks in Oklahoma City don't think this ideology is harmless one bit.
One of the things your book pointed out to me that I had no idea and hadn't really followed, and I'm sure, again, if I had really looked into it, as you say, the documents are there. What is the name of the journal, The Southern Partisan? And then
yes,
there's the book by the Kennedy. I guess they're brothers.
Yes, these are two neo-Confederate Kennedys.
Right.
Go ahead. The South was right.
The South was right. Right. I was going to say that's the basic premise of their book. And also this guy, Frank Connor. These are things that still play a very, not just, you know, symbolic role in American politics today, but actually some of these people have direct links to whether it's the Christian fundamentalist movement or McCain's campaign or any of these things.
They do. Trent Lott was tied in with them. Of course, he's out of politics now, but he wasn't. He was minority leader of the Senate, sometimes majority leader, depending on which side James Jeffers was on.
All right, Jim, one last question here. Speaking from your heart, from the very bottom of your heart, the importance of this book today and why people should pick this thing up.
Here's what I want folks to do. And I don't usually flog my books. They seem to do okay without it. But I want folks, including black folks, to buy this book with what we usually call the Confederate flag on the cover. It's the battle flag, anyway. Mm-hmm. And I want them to buy it and read it and keep it nice. Don't mark in it. Make your notes on the side on a piece of paper. And then take it to your nearby public high school and give it to your kid's history teacher or your own history teacher if you're young enough to have already just graduated from high school. Hit him upside the head with it and say, look, it's been 150 years. It's time to stop lying. It's time to get this right. It does make a difference. And then, by gosh, maybe we can change these historic sites, for instance, by simply having visitors go who know better and who hit them upside the head with this book and say, no. You cannot make it about states' rights anymore. That is a white supremacist myth. It removes the number one issue, which was race and slavery, from its position at the center of American history, and it just won't do anymore.
Jim Lowen talking about the Confederate and neo-Confederate reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause.
All right, sisters and brothers, we're getting close to the end of the show, and I've got a couple more things from Bob Avakian that I want to share with you. Two more short clips from the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, the first is called Order or Justice? And the second is, What Can We Do? This is the most important question that people can ask today.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice. while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program? We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system, whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, that was Bob Avakian from his new talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests, Ed Rampell, film historian, author, and critic, and writer for The Hollywood Progressive, and James Lowen, sociologist and author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, and The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. As always, you can find book titles, websites, and other information on my guests on my Facebook page. And you can also find it on my website, which is themichaelslateshow.com. I also want to thank the people who worked on today's show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and the engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Troubled Times by Green Day. Talk to you again next week. What good?